best-selling novelist Jamie Attenberg, Big Jones chef Paul Fairbox, and it's time for the Swap Meet with Greg Land. Now, here's your host, a man who only gets up for national shows, Justin Kaufman.
See how that sounds? When we hear Rajon Rondo say, oh, I only get up for the national shows. He actually didn't say this, but people say that around him like it's an okay thing. We all know Rajon. We know Rondo really well. He just gets up for the national games. Okay, great. Thanks. Hate to be a ticket holder who saw the Bulls play the Magic back in January, right? Well, you know, that wasn't a national game. That was a local. That was a regional game, like if they play the Pacers. I don't know why that's sticking with me. I was complaining about that last night. It's Download here on 720 WGN. Good evening. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Excited to be here. Thanks for listening. We have a great show lined up tonight. Jamie Attenberg is back. Jamie Attenberg, the best-selling author. The Middlesteins, we had her in for St. Maisie. She has a new book called All Grown Up. Really, it's amazing to think she did a book that's sort of in a new genre, if you think about this sort of idea of living single in New York City, the sort of Sex in the City genre. But instead of Cosmopolitans and Mr. Big, you get depressing, booze-fueled desperation. That's what you get out of Jamie's book. We'll talk to her about the character, about living in New York City, but also about growing older and being single as a woman. And we will talk with her coming up at the big table, 8 o'clock tonight. Also, we got a lot of great news and sports to talk about, of course. In news today, city council meeting got a little bit electric. Alderman Burke is angry with the Chicago Police Department. We'll find out why. Mike Fouché's in. It's Wednesday night. Ozzy is always in here. From the Daily Line. We'll talk with Mike about the proposal to merge the aviation police with the regular police, some doomsday scenarios when it comes to CPS, including a June 1st situation, whether or not we will have our students in Chicago Public Schools out a few weeks earlier than expected, and also talk about what can be done, what politically can be done when there are situations like we had with the U.S. Steel spill with chromium in Lake Michigan. Is there anything that can be done to prevent that or to make sure that there are more, more political pressure from City Hall to make sure that our freshwater lake is not tampered with? Mike Fouché coming in at 7:30 tonight. Also tonight, Sam Panionovich will join us to talk about those upstart Bulls. It's amazing to think about. And it is interesting because early on, Sam, I'm looking forward to maybe teasing Sam a little bit because he teases me about, you know, I always say the Bulls are, this is the year, really like what they're doing. And as the season unfolded, it was very obvious and apparent that Sam was right and I was wrong in the way that this is not a competitive team. But here they are. They got themselves into the playoffs. That's better than they did last year. And now this is where we get to see whether or not those veterans with all the playoff experience can come together with the chemistry, the Rajon Rondos and Dwayne Wades and the Jimmy Butlers, and be able to put a run together. Up 2-0 on the number one seed Boston Celtics, beating them in Boston. They come home to the United Center on Friday, so we'll talk with Sam about what to expect from that. Also, we'll talk about Appalachian cuisine. That's how you say it. I've always thought it was Appalachian, but it's Appalachian. Appalachian cuisine. We'll talk about Southern heirloom cooking. The chef from Big Jones will be in talking about a big event they have tomorrow night. Do you know what Appalachian food is, Pete?
I do not.
You want to take a...
Something tastes mountainy.
It's very mountainy. It's a lot of greens. It's a lot of sort of, I don't know. Well, you know what? We'll
have the chef tell us.
The chef will tell us. Still having a hard time figuring out. But we'll talk about the Appalachian cuisine coming up here on the Download tonight. And Greg Flam's back. Been a couple weeks. Greg Flam in the Dude Swap Meets. This is where we evaluate your collections, your memorabilia, your junk. It's all on the Swap Meet, 10 o'clock tonight. 312-981-7200.
I'm going through and moving, so I got like a bunch of junk. I'm gonna bombard him with like, you know, old Kiss dolls. How much is a Gene Simmons doll worth?
That's good.
Can't wait.
Yeah. He'll be ready. He'll be ready. He's probably listening now, and he's already writing
looking
it down.
Up.
He's got some questions about. I'll be Greg for a second. What condition is it in?
Mint. It's still mint. Well, I took it out of the box.
Is it the one
for
where?
A photo.
Really?
Dummy.
That's hilarious. Like just now? Like just recently?
Like within like.
So it was in the box. It was all sealed up.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, I know. I'll show people with this picture.
Yeah, because I couldn't get the glare of the box hilarious. Was.
You lost like $15 doing that. Have you not learned from the swap meet from doing this every Wednesday night?
I think $15 might have been generous.
The gram was more important. The Instagram was more important than cashing in on this.
Always go the gram.
Yeah. All right. News, weather, and traffic tonight with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. We're gonna have to give him an extra couple bucks now that he ruined his investment. It's kissed all. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. It's The Download here live, 720 WGN, with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Why don't we kick the show off with the carryout? This, of course, is a nightly segment where I read the news to you at home. You don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Well, after all the political smoke cleared, the primary in the Georgia congressional seat was much ado about nothing, or everything, depending on who you talk to. The Democrat John Ossoff won the primary, but he didn't get 50%. So now there's a runoff, in which case the bazillion Republicans who ran in the primary won't split the party. So essentially, Ossoff had to win outright, and he didn't. So for Democrats, close only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades.
Missed it by that much.
That much. But still, the election results are being called a wake-up call to the Republican Party. Wait, the same wake-up call that was given to the Democrats just 6 months ago? Or was it the wake-up call 3 months before that? So many wake-up calls. I feel bad for Susan at the front desk. I really do. Speaking of wake-up calls, Bill O'Reilly is out at Fox after the network spent $13 million to settle sexual harassment claims, with new claims on the way. The conventional wisdom was that Rupert Murdoch was going to stick with his star, but as pressure mounted and, more importantly, sponsors dropped, Murdoch changed course. So who will replace the most successful newsman in cable news history? Please don't say the bow tie. Please don't say the bow tie. Please don't say the bow tie. Oh, it's the bow tie, isn't it? Tucker Carlson, your New York City hotel lobby table is ready. Oh, that's gross. Closer to home, abortion. Yep, Governor Rauner pledged to veto a bill that would let state employees have abortions on state's insurance plans. The bill would also provide protections and assurances that abortions would stay legal if Roe v. Wade were struck down. This move by Rauner may appease a conservative base, but it spit directly in the face of his past positions. He ran on the idea of being a pro-choice governor. He said he wouldn't get involved in social politics, and now some Democrats and Republicans are calling him out on it. So what's it mean? It means that politics is hard. Sorry, Governor, it's hard. If you need proof of that, here's a little nugget. The Mike Madigan camp, friends of Mike Madigan, have shelled out $150,000-plus for Cubs and Sox tickets. Yep, it's all campaign money. It's legal. And Madigan himself doesn't use money to go to the games. He uses his own money. His office says that the tickets are given as gifts to those who help out on the campaign. Wow, the machine? Wow. Now the machine is, instead of jobs, it's general admission bleacher seats. What's next? People going door to door in the ward for pizza coupons? Ugh, Shackman. J.B. Pritzker's on the campaign trail as he's running for governor on the Democratic ticket. Talking to people at the campus of U of I, he said, in reference to Bruce Rauner, not all billionaires are alike. Yeah, that's true. Some like ground mustard, some like Grey Poupon. Some like the Porsche, some like the Porsche SUV. Some believe in funding public schools, some just put their names on schools. Wait, they all put their names on schools. Aren't you supposed to, like, I don't know, pass on before we name stuff after you? I mean, this is going to be the first election where all the candidates have pavilions. Think about that. McHenry County Board Chair Jack Frank said he received death threats on a McHenry County political blog in the comments section. He and his family are getting protection from the sheriff's office. So it just goes to show you, people read the comments. There you go. You're stars. You have successfully taken taxpayers' money with your dumb comments on a political blog. A security breach at the Holiday Inn? No, they didn't jimmy the lock and steal your Keurig machine. Nope. A phishing scam netted thousands of credit card numbers. You know the crooks are just going to use your credit card for the mini bar. It's pretty simple. It's going to be a lot of those mini Pringles showing up on your bill. Chicago lakefront visitors were shocked and surprised when a fisherman pulled a muskie out of Lake Michigan. A muskie? Well, it was a bluegill, then the chromium spill, and boom, it's a muskie. Muskies are in Lake Michigan, but rare this far south. But then again, have you tried to tell a muskie which way to swim? They don't listen. They're like teenagers. Do what I want to swim. I'll swim where I want. Leave me alone. I'm a muskie. I can swim where I want. In weather, well, it's rainy today, but at least it's not raining meteors. That's going to be this weekend. So always look on the bright side. In sports, the Cubs are back, baby. A 3-run walk-off homer for Addison Russell ends the homestand in style to take the series from the Brew Crew. And now our game or so back from the Reds. The Reds, give me a break. The classic Cubs today, huh? Just grinding it out and winning in dramatic fashion. Are you watching, Hawks? The Sox hope to take the series in New York against the Yankees. They started slow, though, getting beat early. Last night, Avi Garcia hit a 3-run bomb and continues to be an early season bright spot. He did this a couple years ago before he went broke his wrist. Remember, they broke his wrist diving for a line drive, and then he was out, and he has never been the same player. So hopefully we'll see a full season of this production. Also, who is Miguel Gonzalez? I don't know. I know he's been on the Sox for like 2.5 years, but he pitched into the 9th inning last night. Maybe the best Sox starter right now. So Sox are one game back to the Twins. Twins, give me a break. The Bulls are coming back to the UC with a 2-0 lead in the best of 7 series. Remember when the first round was a best of 5? Couldn't we do that right now? Wouldn't it be great if that was it right now? Just make it retroactive of some sort. The Bulls have looked like the dominant team with Butler, Wade, and Rondo doing their thing. Nice to see the Bulls' strategy pay off here because it took all of 82 games to make the playoffs. But 2 first round wins against the number 1 seed? Gar Forman, John Paxson, your table is ready. Now that table will be quickly taken away if the Bulls don't win this series, but you can sit at it for now until someone else comes along. The Blackhawks are preparing for their Game 4 elimination game in Nashville tomorrow night. The game will be broadcast right here on WGN. They got a serious mountain to climb, but it all starts with winning tomorrow. The one game at a time mantra definitely applies, although 3 games at a time would be a much better mantra right now. Blackhawks are used to having their backs against the wall. They seem to do it every year, but like last year against St. Louis, the concept doesn't really play out perfectly year to year. In other words, stop it. let's go ahead. I'd be okay with a 2-1 lead right about now. And a reminder, just over a week, the Bears will screw up the NFL draft, so that's coming up. Actually, OTAs are underway, so if you love your football in the form of running around orange cones, this is your favorite time of the year. And finally, tonight, a new study says that salt makes you hungry, not thirsty. Well, I have a new study for you. Stop spending money on stupid studies. What that? That's the carryout for April 19, 2017. In honor of the carryout's 2-year anniversary, we're giving away 2-year-old ketchup packets. Yep, they don't go bad. They just, if anything, they just get better with age. All right, coming up, Mike Fouché from the Daily Line. We'll talk about why Alderman Burke is mad at the Chicago Police Department. We'll also talk about doomsday scenarios for Chicago public schools. Lots to get at. We'll do it right after the news here on The Download on 720 WGN. Stay with us. All right, I will say this. You know, I mentioned the carryout being 2 years old. It's because today, it's a 2-year anniversary of the Download. Yeah. I'll wait. I'll wait for your applause.
That's amazing.
Yeah, right? It was right around this time because I remember, I knew it was coming up, but then LinkedIn shot a bunch of, I got a bunch of, it's the worst thing ever. When you have an anniversary on LinkedIn, it's the worst. Because it's just like everyone just sends you a message, says, hey, John Thompson sent you a message on LinkedIn. You're like, well, first of all, don't. And then second of all, it's just a standard like form. It's like congrats on your anniversary. Like it's just you hit a button or something on LinkedIn and it like sends a message to me. And I'm like, all right, enough. No, I don't know.
Do you don't respond? You don't engage?
No. It's probably a button that says congratulate Justin, you hit it. And then what LinkedIn does is it sends me an email saying LinkedIn John from LinkedIn has sent you a message. So you're like, oh, who's John? And you look at it and it's just congrats on your anniversary. Congrats on your work anniversary. That's what I got. I got 30 of those today.
That's nice that people are congratulating
you. Yeah, but they're not. They're hitting a button like as almost like a networking thing. They're not necessarily like, oh, that's great for Justin. I don't know any of these people. It's not like, you know, Pete, if you see it on LinkedIn, you're like, oh, that's great for Justin. I'll hit.
Not like Facebook where you see something, you like it. Or
like happy birthday, you go happy birthday. And mm-hmm. sometimes you can choose, you know, present or something like that. But you go and do that. This is more like a networking thing. Rob Martier, is this the same Rob Martier I just saw on CNN?
I don't know. Could have been.
I was having a hard time doing a carryout out of the corner of my eye. I see Rob doing some punditry. I like it.
I was a little worried, you know, because the camera adds, what, about 15, 20 pounds?
Good.
I'm about 30 pounds overweight, so that puts me at about 50 pounds overweight on TV.
You know who you look like? You look like a Lou Ferrigno in his prime.
I sound in shape on the radio, though.
How was it? Good segment?
Yeah, it was all right. It was a follow-up on the story about this young woman who was murdered in Schaumburg on Easter Sunday. Tragic story. So they were kind of following up on that, and they had their other talking heads, the legal analyst there as well. So it's always a little uncomfortable when you're doing something like that because you're hearing them, and you're staring straight into the camera.
Right.
And you're not quite sure if you're...
And what backdrop? Is there like a skyline backdrop?
Yeah, it's a Chicago skyline backdrop. Oh. You know, I asked for makeup and some water and chocolates and stuff, but they weren't prepared for that.
Instead, they said you got to go back and do a newscast.
Right, exactly.
All right. Well, hey, you look good. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, you know, in studio every Wednesday, Mike Fouché joins us.
Yeah.
A little walk-in music, walk hard there.
Yeah, love that.
You know, I think we should talk about city council. Obviously, you know, the big news in Chicago was the woman taking off her shirt at Wrigley Field.
Yeah,
that's
right.
That's the thing. But other stuff happened in Chicago today, including a meeting at city council where Alderman Burke, who for all purposes is the spokesperson for the council, is upset with the Chicago Police Department.
Hey, you know, it was interesting because yesterday his press secretary, Michael Sneed, ran a column about this. she basically said that he's very upset at the city police force because they have a much larger press office than they claim to have. And that there shouldn't be that many police officers working in the news affairs office, and that they shouldn't be busy answering questions from poor slobs like me. They should be out, you know.
Right. He's saying that too many police officers are at desk duty answering media questions.
Media questions.
Should be working the beat.
Right, right. And, you know, there's actually something to be said for this that, you know, maybe you don't necessarily need a full police officer doing that stuff. But anyway, he really hauled off in city council today. He said he said that you can't trust the word of the Chicago Police Department anymore. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. The Chicago Police Department has bamboozled us. And that was, I mean, he went on for like 10 minutes.
But his point being that the Chicago Police Department isn't necessarily forthcoming about how many officers are working in the media.
In the news affairs office, and that actually they're budgeted for a different number of police officers, and that the police department has played, you know, little games with their headquarters budget so that there would be more police officers working in news affairs than actually doing other paper pushing things in the headquarters. I don't know. And he's mad about this. What's interesting is, you know, this came completely out of left field. And if you know anything about Ed Burke, it's that he loves to give a good speech about how great police officers are.
Yeah.
And how
time there's a council meeting, he starts with that.
And he loves to talk about how great police officers are. And he loves to talk about how he once worked on the beat for a few minutes and that, you know, he did all these things. And, you know, that it was a stunner to hear him give the speech, which basically means somebody in the police department ticked him off.
Right.
And now he's getting his revenge.
And Alderman Burke has served the council for years, and he continues to be
served Chicagoans in the city council
for years. But there are more often there are times where there will be these, and I don't want to call them nonsensical. That's not the right word. But these, they're kind of limited interest kind of advocating,
yeah,
if
right,
you will, for,
yeah,
at the beginning of a council, yeah, meeting, where he takes time, he takes minutes,
right,
sometimes hours.
We
to
need
kind
to
of go through
ban
this.
Cell phone cases that look like guns.
Right.
That was
and,
like
and then
one
it becomes a news
things.
Story.
Right.
I mean, yeah, it kind of, in a weird way, you listen because it's Alderman Burke, but at the same time, he's kind of getting in the way of the bigger issues that need
doing
to be discussed.
Stuff. Yeah. He was fired up. I mean, and what's crazy is at the same time, there's also this other major police issue that's floating around, which is what to do with the aviation, yeah, police at the airport. Aviation police are not the same as the Chicago Police Department. Aviation police are under the O'Hare infrastructure. They don't answer to the superintendent. They have different training. They still go through the police academy. They don't carry a gun. And they cost a little less, actually.
So there's been movement to say, you know what, let's have regular police officers at the airport instead of the aviation police. This in response to what
we
saw with the dragging the passenger off.
Alderman Raymond Lopez, who actually was a baggage handler at Midway Airport before he became alderman, said we should have regular police officers there on the plane who carry guns, that are fully trained, that should be doing this sort of thing. And, you know, this actually Matt McGrath, the mayor's press secretary, said the problem on the airplane was bad judgment. It wasn't the fact,
yeah,
that somebody
didn't have
a gun.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, this isn't, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong.
We're talking about the United Airlines,
yeah,
flight.
You know, when you talk about the aviation force or the police force, the aviation officers that were involved, I mean, do they have a bad reputation? I mean, is this the kind of thing where, because
no,
we've heard the stories, no, in the paper about whether they should be armed or not.
Right.
But we've never really heard them as some rogue force that are coming,
no,
out, and you hear these mythical,
no,
stories of, you know, dragging passengers off.
No.
Until this point, they pretty much had a clean record.
They pretty much did. And, you know,
so it's a little knee-jerk to be like,
I think so. And I think that there's a lot of trying to figure out what's going to happen here, because the city's going to get sued clearly by Dr. Dow, as well as United Airlines. And, you know, I think people want to be able to show action. And there's a lot of sensitivity, basically, about anything that has to do with police in the city of Chicago, because of all of the violence problems, because of all of the accusations of racism in the police department, and that there is a blue wall of silence. You know, all of the various things that are going on. And also, now we're getting ready to get into the police contract negotiations. The folks at the FOP say that they're going to be fighting for every last thing that's going to be in the police contract. There's a number of items in the police contract that were pointed out by the DOJ in their report last January that are egregious, terrible things. And, you know, the Black Caucus says that they'll vote against anything that doesn't get rid of those items. So everyone is
right
charged
now is
up
charged
about
up,
police.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is, yeah, so it kind of comes at the wrong time to have this sort of national embarrassment for O'Hare,
right,
for United Airlines, for the city of Chicago,
right,
around a force that not a lot of people know about.
Not a lot of people know a lot about it, you know, and it is kind of this strange, it falls into this strange category. And, you know, it's really in a lot of ways kind of a budget trick, I think, is how it got started, because the O'Hare Airport has a completely separate budget, which doesn't affect all the other things, and it's all paid for by gate fees, and it's self-sustaining. And so I think that one of the reasons why there's been this separate aviation police is in order to keep that cost in that bucket rather than it being going to other things that are paid for in the city.
Mike Fouché is with the Daily Line. He joins us every Wednesday here on the Download. We'll take a quick break, come back. We should talk about doomsday scenarios for Chicago Public Schools. That
really?
Came up. Really?
That'd be great.
June,
yeah,
1st, of course. Not the end of school, but
no,
could be the end of school
could
based
be.
On
it's a threat.
Funds. It's a threat. We'll talk about that coming up here after the break on the Download. Stay with us. It's a Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio with us every Wednesday night. Mike Fouché from the Daily Line. We talk all things Chicago.
County.
State politics.
Illinois.
Let's talk a little Indiana politics or maybe just
please,
industry. But
oh,
I thought this was an interesting story. We kind of touched on this in the promo today. this idea of the political fallout of the spill, the chromium spill from U.S. Steel. This happened last week, and you know, it turned
hexachromium.
It turned out that it's all okay. It looks like the water's fine. It wasn't that big of a deal. But Mayor Emanuel had tough words for essentially a company that's out of his jurisdiction.
Totally.
You know, U.S. Steel is an Indiana company, but essentially said we need answers on when you knew about it, how much was in there, what are the precautions. He seemed to really want to sort of defend Lake Michigan as Chicago's Lake Michigan.
Well, it's an easy hit for him. You know, I mean, he's not really liable for any of it. The city's not liable. The city doesn't have any responsibility over it. The city doesn't have any jurisdiction. So he can rant and rave and yell and scream as much as he wants. It's sort of like, you know, anytime there's crime in the city, you see somebody from the Cook County Board jumping up and down and saying the city of Chicago needs to fix things.
And you don't hear a city of Chicago politician saying anything.
Right. You know, so, you know, he can yell as much as he wants about Indiana. The fact is that it's over the border. The Indiana EPA is very lax, you know, certainly in comparison to a lot of other places. My family actually grew up on the lakefront. My mom and uncles lived there as kids. And, you know, in the 1950s, growing up literally right next door to U.S. Steel, they were a nightmare. You know, they're throwing all kinds of stuff up in the air and dumping all kinds of stuff in the water all the time. It wasn't really until the federal EPA showed up and started making standards when they really started to clean up. And that's basically the deal. You know, it's whether or not the federal EPA is going to be able to enforce thing, is going to be able to chase after.
But the mayor has somewhat of a point in the sense that is the freshwater lake is a drinking supply, and it's where we get our water, and the city gets our water. So anyone who shares that water supply should treat it in a certain way. So does he have any sort of jurisdictional power to say you can't do that?
No, that's why we have the federal EPA and the Clean Water Act. The Clean Water Act was basically set up in response to a lot of these things from rivers and Lake Michigan. I mean, you know, you have Lake Erie that was getting all kinds of stuff dumped into it from Cleveland.
And that affects somebody in Pennsylvania. Right.
Right. Yeah. And actually, Green Bay was dumping all kinds of PCBs into the city of Green Bay was dumping all kinds of PCBs into the Green Bay on Lake Michigan. And it was really EPA that got a lot of that to stop. The U.S. EPA, there's not a whole lot that individual states can do when you have a body like Lake Michigan. And, you know, that's why we have EPA.
Mm. Yeah. Let's talk schools. This has been the threat that's kind of been simmering underneath. And today it was brought up, the idea that because of the ongoing budget situation for Chicago Public Schools, there may be a situation, and this is a threat, but there's a situation that we could see the end of the school year 3 weeks earlier
on
June 1st. Is that a reality? I mean, is that something – are we playing political games with Springfield, or is that something that's really been drawn up as something that CPS is considering?
Well, it depends on who you talk to and what day. I mean, I think that there's general consensus among city leaders that there's no way that CPS will close on June 1st. But the mayor – today, in a press conference, Fran Spielman from the Sun-Times asked him, "Mayor, are you really going to close CPS 3 weeks early?" And the mayor didn't answer it. She jumped on him and said, "Wait a minute, you didn't answer my question." He still didn't answer it. Then Greg Hines from Cranes asked the question again, and he didn't answer it. And Greg Hines said, "No, you really haven't answered my question." And the mayor didn't answer it again, and then he went on to go leave. So, you know, really, the mayor is in a jam here. What he needs is $250 million for CPS because that's how much they're short. And that was the money that CPS was counting on in order to make it for this school year. And there was originally going to be the $250 million voted by the state legislature, and then Rauner vetoed it. Well, they need that cash in order to keep the schools open. And they've said June 1st is the day when we run out of money. So what they're counting on is for the state legislature to make some kind of grand bargain before June 1st. Now, the state legislature has a lot of other things that they got to take care of with their own budget. And so I think that what Emanuel is hoping is that they'll wedge in something at the last minute for CPS. The moment that they
they are not going to do that.
The moment that Emanuel says, "Oh, hey, we might pay for it ourselves," that's basically putting up the white flag. And then Rahner and other Republicans could say, see, we made Chicago pay their own bills. They don't really need us
So it
anyway.
Is a game of chicken that continues
Absolutely,
here.
It's a game of chicken.
I guess the reason I just kind of had that epiphany is that June 1st, you know, is also shares the date as the end of the spring session in Springfield.
Yeah, that's right.
The
May
end
30th
of, yeah, right.
is the end of spring
so,
session.
So my point being that you're going to see politics ramp up.
It's going to go berserko.
Whether or not we – because but the truth of the matter is this is where it gets interesting. We've talked about this. If they don't get a budget done in Springfield and they don't deal with CPS funding in Springfield by June 1st, there's a great chance that they will not deal with either of those issues until after a gubernatorial election.
Yeah. And there's actually there's a number of legislators that I've spoken to that said I don't think that there's going to be a budget deal, and I think that we're not going to see a budget until after 2018. I mean, there's already legislators that think that it's a done deal,
that we're not going to
that
see
well, nothing will happen,
that we're going to go a full 4-year term of a sitting governor without a budget and without some of these things.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a whole series of dominoes that are starting to fall now. Already the universities are having a hard time borrowing in order to be able to make it. The state universities, public universities, the smaller ones, not the big guys like UIC and Champaign, but all the smaller ones are running into trouble.
Illinois,
Northeastern, Northern Illinois, Western Illinois, Southern Illinois, they're running into money problems. And Chicago State. So, you know, there's other stuff that's happening, too. There's all these nonprofits that are threatening to close. It's a bad scene.
Mike Fouché with The Daily Line joins us every Wednesday. Like I said, I mean, we're coming up. There's going to be a month and a half here of some serious politics coming up in Chicago and Springfield. And you'll be here every Wednesday to break it down. Mike,
Can't wait
to see you. Thanks for being here.
Good to be here.
You know, it's just you talk to Mike and you get the concept that it almost becomes like the Matrix, like we're just living the same life over and over. And when you think about that last week of May, I had like flashes to a different life 6 years ago, 7 years ago, that last week's going to be important. This idea of the budget, all this politics in the last week. And we've been asking as taxpayers to not do that so hectic in the last 3 days. And we saw with when you're dealing with ideological differences like the Republicans and Democrats are right now, you can't play that kind of political game where you come down in the 25th hour and you know, do the old Chicago machine, jam it down the throat, and then you're like, all right, hey, we got it. It doesn't work.
But do you guys remember a time when it hasn't been this way?
I cannot
remember a time where it's been kind of a massaging sort of thing. They've negotiated and they've come to an agreement. I don't think it's ever happened.
I mean, it also scares you because you're like, well, what does that mean for CPI? Are they going to be doing the threat of closing the Chicago public schools up to June 1st? Is it going to be May 29th and parents in Chicago are going to be like, are we done in 2 days or are we done, like you said, in 3 weeks? I mean, that's a crazy thought to think that they would push this all the way to the push the needle all the way like that.
It's not mutually exclusive to this state, but look, what's gone on here over since the beginning of time is criminal. It's absolutely criminal.
That's a good word for it. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNradio.com. Coming up, we'll change gears. We'll talk with best-selling novelist Jamie Attenberg. Jamie's back in studio. We had her on almost over the last 2 summers ago with her book St. Maisie. She's got a new one. She's getting great reviews, all grown up. We will talk with Jamie Attenberg coming up.
I realize that she has written more books in the last like 3 years than I've read. Very sad.
That's pretty sad. Well, Jamie is in studio at the big table tonight. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Well, my next guest is a New York Times bestselling author. Her books, The Middlesteins and St. Maisie, are just two of her critically acclaimed works. Jamie Attenberg is back, and in a big way, with the novel All Grown Up, which follows a single woman in New York City not searching for love, marriage, and family. Instead, she's searching for a place, a purpose, and a connection. Or you know what? Maybe she's not searching for anything. And that's what makes this character work, broken up into several short stories about her travels, her lives, her relationships. Jamie Attenberg currently lives in New Orleans, and she grew up right here in Buffalo Grove, and she returns tonight to The Download to be my guest at the big table. Jamie, great to see you. Thanks for being back.
It's nice to see you, too. And I think you did a really good job of describing the book.
Did I?
I'm really, I feel seen by you. Yeah.
Well, I wanted to tell you this, and we were talking before you came on air, and I saved it. But I was in New York City not too long ago, and we stayed in the Lower East Side. Mm-hmm. And I was walking around there, and I was walking through all the tenements and stuff, and I found myself going, this is where St. Maisie lived. This is mm-hmm. I was like, this is it. I was having this frame of connection around your work, and I thought that it was really cool to think about. And so your work has stuck with me for months, so that's good.
That's wonderful. Yeah, I was just back in New York, and I was walking on the Bowery, which looks so different, obviously, than how it used to look. But there's still some buildings, and I always kind of channel her when I'm there. Yeah, I still think about her a lot. So that's cool.
I felt there was some connection to her and to Andrea, who's the main character of the new book, in the way that St. Maisie was about the ideas of relationships with men and family is going to be to the side. And she had this way of, that she really just wanted to help people. Mm. I felt that similar vibe from Andrea in the way that in her life, she wasn't hung up on the things that people think you should be hung up on when you're in your 30s. And at the same time, she did, in a way, she wanted to help people, especially strangers.
Wow. So that's a generous reading of Andrea. Some people don't feel the same way about her at all. They see her as a little bit more self-involved than that. But thank you. That's really a nice reading on her. Yeah, I mean, there are, and even some people might see in the Middlesteins like an unconventional female character. I mean, these are the kinds of characters that I'm drawn to and kind of am always going to write a strong female character because I think it's important to have that out there in the world. And that's just who I'm interested in. But of course, they're all really deeply flawed characters,
right,
too. But I don't know. I don't think I would want to write a nice character, really, or a sweet character, because those people aren't very interesting to me. I saw I've just been in the throes of reviews and really in the eye of the storm. I've been on the road for the last 3 weeks since the book has come out. So I've seen all different kinds of interpretations of Andrea. Some people think she's really funny and some people really identify with her and some people don't like her, but still somehow have enjoyed the book. I saw one review where they called her mildly irritating. And I was like, that's like literally half the people I know I would call mildly irritating. And I would also call myself mildly irritating.
I thought she was real. I mean, in the way
I
don't know if there is such a thing as a sweet character. I mean, that's not a real thing. So for her to be funny and witty, but also at the same time broken in the way that she's approaching her life and be dull in some ways and find a way to like use or to dull out the edges. I think that's just what we're all like.
Right. I mean, my intention was to write an honest portrayal of a woman and a human being just in contemporary society. And that's kind of, you know, there's a lot of time shifting in the book where you see her at the age of 13, one of the chapters, and you see her at the age of 8, or you'll see her at 28 or 39, and so I wanted just to have this like really full 360 picture of who she was in it, and that includes the flaws.
Well, I want to talk about the flaws because I think it's interesting too, because this is it's mind bending in a way to think that this is now a genre, and there's been a lot to the single woman's adventures in New York City. It's become like a literary genre. You can find a category for this. But in this case, I mean, what I liked about it, I kind of said in the beginning, was this idea of what she's searching for.
Right.
And I read some interviews with you just about this idea that when you think of things like Sex and the City and other places, at the end, there is always this, they're going to find something. They finally found the right guy. They mm-hmm. finally found their family, and it all worked out. And in this case, and in this book with Andrea, that's not the end goal. That's not the end game of this book
right.
or her character.
Yeah, I didn't. There's no way I was going to write a book where the main goal of the character was to find a husband.
But a lot of times they'll go, oh, I'm never going to get married. And at the end, some guy walks in.
Just
they're like,
sneaks in there.
Sneaks in. Oh, but Dave's different,
yeah,
right?
And I don't know. I just I do feel like sometimes, you know, feminism gets a little sacrificed for the Hollywood ending in our culture. So I don't know. My intention with this book was just to step into the shoes of somebody who knew what she didn't want, which was to not get married or have a kids or have any of the trappings of normal adult life. I wanted to see what that actually felt like and learn from that and expand that character and see and also have that character exist for other people to see as well, because I just wasn't seeing it out there that much.
Yeah.
And I mean, here and there you do see it, but I just kind of wanted to like create it so that it just existed. I mean, that's why we make art, right, is so that we can see the things that we want to see that aren't there.
Jamie Attenberg's my guest in studio. She's the author of All Grown Up, which is a national bestseller as well. It's on its way. Congrats for all the great reviews. And she is in Chicago signing books, I think, at an alarming pace.
Yeah.
It's just like you just see she signed 30 books while she's been sitting here in the interview. No. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back, and we'll continue the conversation here tonight on The Download. Jamie Attenberg, my guest at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio, Jamie Attenberg, the best-selling author. Her new novel is out, All Grown Up. And, you know, I really enjoyed the character Andrea, and that this book is about a woman in New York City who lives in Brooklyn. She has a great view of the Empire State Building, and she's an artist who draws the Empire State Building from her window until, you know, the views aren't there anymore.
Right.
But what I loved about it was this, the complexity of creating a character that doesn't want to do the same old things, doesn't want to necessarily find the right man and get married and do the whole thing. And even you know, in a certain way, doesn't want to play the game at work and do things like that. But it also is flawed in the way that she's an artist and she kind of gave up on it. And some things that she did want, she either didn't necessarily finish it or didn't necessarily follow her dreams. So there's some complexities there.
Yeah. You know, I was interested in these traditional milestones of life, of the getting married, having a baby, knowing what your career path is, buying a house, all those things, and thinking, what if none of those things apply to you? But you still have gotten older. And in fact, you might actually be an adult. And what does it mean to be an adult? And I actually think that you could, like, for example, get married, and that doesn't even right. mean that you're an adult. I was thinking a lot this year about it. I kind of didn't even really want to write this book at first, because I thought, oh, if I write it, then I actually have to figure out what it means to be in it. Like, then I was going to be forced to look at my own life, even though my life is much different than her life. I still had to have an answer to the question of what it means to be a grown up. So I have an answer now. Do you want to know what it is?
I do. I was going to follow up with it.
This is just for me, and I don't know if it really applies to everybody. But what I decided after talking to lots of people about it and seeing their answers is it's about owning the decisions that you make, knowing why you're making the decisions you're making, and taking responsibility for those choices. So, for example, if you got married, but you didn't know why you were getting married, and you didn't feel responsible to the person you were getting married,
right.
I don't think that that necessarily means you're a grown-up just because you've sort of ticked off that thing on the list. So, yeah, I was interested in, like, figuring out what it meant and watching the character grow to a certain point and find her own way towards adulthood in this book.
You've written, as you talked about, different characters in different books, and even with the last one, St. Maisie, was really historical fiction. We had a long convo about that. Is it harder for you as an author, as a writer, to write characters that are similar in age, in style, in contemporary? Just the idea of Andrea could be you. I'm not saying that she is, but the idea that she could be your peer. Is it harder to write characters that way?
No, I always thought of her as a neighbor of mine, right? And even with Maisie, it got to that place too, even though I obviously didn't live in her era. Because you study them for so long, mm-hmm. and they just sort of feel like they live five blocks away from you. And you know the paths that they take, this, you know, how they walk on the street and where they're eating. And, you know, you think that you create that universe.
Yeah.
And this one, because I was coming off of writing Maisie, which was set in the 20s, this one was actually quite a relief to write because it's set now. And I didn't have to invent a way of talking. And I didn't have
You're
to,
right.
you know, and I didn't have to invent really in a way anything, although I invented quite a bit with this, but I'd lived in New York City for so long. I'd lived there for 18 years that I was like, oh, I know this landscape.
It's easy to be authentic.
I knew this landscape so well. And same thing when I wrote The Middlesteins and I had set it in the suburbs of Chicago, even though it's a totally different family than mine. And I'd never met any of those people. I knew what it looked like. I knew where they would have gone. And it was so I think that's if anything, that's my cheat, although it's not really a cheat at all. But I think using familiar landscapes to me, Maisie took me much longer to write because I had to really do a lot of research.
Yeah, so you had to stop and be like, okay, I need to figure out what the Bowery was at that point.
Yeah, how to get in the room with the characters. So I don't know. They all have different voices to me, though.
The character in All Grown Up, as we've talked about, Andrea, has a lot of flaws. And the flaws are not necessarily fatal, but they're mistakes that she makes, and she has a hard time connecting with people, and she's constantly having issues. There's one great scene where her sister-in-law, they're in a restaurant, and the character Andrea is more interested in what's happening at the table next, the drama that's happening next, the stranger. Mm. And instead of connecting with what the sister-in-law is trying to talk about her family or her issues and problems, when you're creating a character and the character has, and you say, okay, the character's going to have these flaws, do you go to the center and try to find the fatal one? like the one that creates the character. I mean, do you go that deep? I mean, I know there's the relationship with the father, and I mean, do you go to say that's the center point? That's where all the rest of these sort of non-fatal flaws come from this one flaw.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that was like a really crucial scene with her father without giving anything away. There's just a scene with her father from her childhood. And that scene that you mentioned with her sister-in-law, where that's probably her lowest point in a way in the book, where she's just being kind of a jerk, a little bit narcissistic. And we really, when I was in the editing process, we really struggled with that because I knew that she was being bad, but I didn't want the audience to think, like I wanted the audience to struggle with it, right? I didn't just want it to be like...
It's so obvious, right?
Yeah, and so one of the things that we did when we were revising it is I say we because I'm talking about my editor here, but... and she really pushed me to do this, is I allowed her sister-in-law, Greta, to yell at her more.
Right.
Which initially she didn't kind of like give her the business. And then I thought, oh, you know, the audience needs to know that we know.
Well, it helps us formulate that the behavior is bad.
Yeah. But people are bad. I mean, we just are not perfect all the time. No. We screw up all the time sometimes we can't be there for people. I know perfectly lovely people who just never call their mothers ever. Right? Because they just don't want to talk to their mothers. Or people who have bad breakups and don't behave well in that breakup, but you still like them and you still know them and you know that they're not a bad person. Sometimes we just are bad.
Yeah.
And we're dealing with
tragedy in different ways that people expect you to, you know, like in this book, there's a lot about family and a sick family member. And it's like, and the way that the character reacts to that is one that a lot of people in the family are perplexed about how she won't go there.
Right, but there's nobody knows how to
nobody
be.
Knows.
We're all trying to figure out how to be. And I think that in writing this book, even though again, like these are not my situations, I think with every book it helps me to learn how to be a little bit better and a little bit wiser and a little bit more grown up myself, because I, you know, put all my characters through their paces and ask questions that I like, sort of like, what would I do in this situation? And even when I have the character do something I would never do in that situation, it has forced me to engage with it. It's the way I learn to. I'm learning as much.
Do you ask the questions or write the character because you're interested in learning about it, or do you learn after the fact?
You know, I actually, a mix obviously, but with this book, I actually made a list of things that I wanted to have happen to her and issues that I wanted her to engage with, which is the closest thing to an outline like I'll ever have. But I was just sort of like, Andrea's best friend has a baby and she hates babies. Like, I'm going to do a chapter on that, you know, or Andrea's, you know, best friend gets married and she goes to the wedding, even though she hates weddings, like that, those kinds of things where I was thinking, just put her in the, you know, in the mud and let her claw her way out and see what happens. Yeah.
It's also, I mean, and in a way, by doing that exercise and letting the character claw out, you learn more about yourself as a writer.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it was really fun to write this book, and really, I felt very playful with it. Yeah, it was very entertaining. And I kind of, you know, because there's all that time shifting and chapters in different years, it was, for me, I wanted it to be playful for the reader, where they just never knew what they were going to get. That every chapter they're like, all right, now we're in 1986 and now we're in 2015. And that's kind of a way of building suspense or giving the reader a ride.
Jamie Attenberg is the author of All Grown Up, national bestseller, just announced. She is in Chicago. She's on a tour. She spends her days now in New Orleans, although she grew up in Buffalo Grove right here in town. Let's take a quick break. We'll get an update on tonight's news, and we'll come back with more with author Jamie Attenberg here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio, Jamie. Good to see you.
Hi.
Jamie Attenberg, a longtime author. She is a bestseller, a New York Times bestselling author for books like The Middlesteins and then St. Maisie. And her new book is now a national bestseller, All Grown Up, getting great reviews. She's in Chicago for the tour, but also, you know, I mean, it's kind of like a homecoming in a way. You're back you grew up in Buffalo Grove, Illinois.
I wish I had more time here, but I don't, because usually I come here and my parents live in Buffalo Grove, and they lived there for 50 years and they just retired to Florida.
Oh.
And I was so bummed, because usually I come for a week and then I get to do events at my hometown library and I get to like schmooze a little bit and hang out with people. And today I only get to come really just for like the one day. And I was like, I got to like figure out. I need like a new set of parents here.
I was
going to
say
like
this
that.
Is it, well, Pete and I will be your parents. You can come visit us every time we come through. But this just becomes another nameless city for you.
No, I don't want that. I don't like it. I don't want it to be that way at all. And I was in Milwaukee yesterday, and then we drove through, and I was like, God, everything's so Midwestern. I love it so much. I do, and my accent changes a little bit when I start talking to a lot of Midwesterners, and. Yeah, it's nice to be here. I still think of it as home. So,
and it's interesting, you know, because the books, part of this book, All Grown Up, which is out now, it has a couple of aspects to Chicago. I mean, you talk about the character Andrea at one point or another living in Wicker Park.
I couldn't resist.
You couldn't resist.
I can't resist throwing Chicago in there when I can.
Why?
And St. Maisie, too. I had a little Chicago
right,
in there as
right.
well. I don't know. I just like it. I like to, it makes me feel safe to write about Chicago. Yeah.
Just because it's something you can relate to?
It gives me pleasure to think about Chicago. So it's my own little Easter egg. I have a couple of Easter eggs. Like I always write about food because that makes me happy. I like to write about sex because it entertains me. And I like to put, you know, at least one Chicago chapter in a book. Just, I don't know, I just like thinking about Chicago.
The character is complex in that way. I mean, with her relationship to sex, her relationship to her relationships. There seems to be less, like we talked about at the beginning, this idea of this Hollywood ending. But there seems to be less desire for them to work out. You know, it doesn't seem like she's ever in a spot where and the only reason I think about it is I'm watching the show Love on Netflix right now.
Yeah.
And you're like, that guy, the main character, that's all he wants. He's just like kind of like bumbling through it and he loves it. But I think of Andrea, it's just like these two things that are happening at the same time, reading this and watching that show. And I'm like, it almost like she feels like it's never going to work out, or that at a certain point, like, no, this will blow up. If I have sex with this guy, it's going to blow up.
Yeah. I mean, she's just not capable. I mean, that's a great thing that she knows about herself, that she's not capable of being the person that should be in a relationship.
But does she undermine herself by, or does anyone who has that, who feels like they know themselves so well, do they undermine themselves for being happy in any form?
I don't know. I think she's not. I just don't think she's really that interested in it. Like whatever it is that she could get out of a relationship, like the trade-off is not enough for her. I mean, she just, yeah, she's not into it, man. She's just not that into it.
Well, there's some great through lines when you talk about the relationship with your family. You know, with Andrea's family. You talk about her mom, her brother, her sister-in-law. But there's something interesting about this idea that as a single woman, she is not attached. Like, she doesn't have the care of the world. She doesn't worry about babies. She doesn't worry about family. She's got it great. But there's this element in here in which everybody needs somebody to lean on. And in this case, Andrea sometimes forgets that. And this idea of almost, you know, single doesn't necessarily mean unattached. There are still responsibilities.
That's
to,
right.
You know what I mean?
That's definitely like a lesson of the book, I think.
Why go there? I mean, talk about that. Talk about why is that the lesson of the book?
Because she does need other people. She needs humanity and she needs to connect with people. And she does know that. But sometimes she shuts herself down and she kind of has to be reminded of it throughout the book. And to me, like, that's the ending of the book, which of course we will not share. But like, that's her sort of getting her act together and figuring that part out about herself. It's also like, I think that when you live sometimes in an urban existence, it's really easy to just get distracted by everything that's going on around you. And your friends can become your family also, which I think is really important. Yeah. And sometimes you don't even want to deal with your real family. And you're not obligated to, let me just say that. But for Andrea, I think it's something that she does want. But she, you know, part of the book is that some of her family members moved to another part, to move to New Hampshire. And so she just sort of shuts them out. And they're kind of like, no, you're not. Just because we're not here doesn't mean that you can't,
right.
That you can forget about us.
And there's this part of the book where you reveal that the character, she talks to her brother and her sister-in-law every Sunday.
Mm.
But that's not connection. It's almost like it's an obligation. It's an
obligation.
It's a routine. And even in that, she has removed herself from it.
Yeah, I think people just often do that, right? Like they were like, well, I just make my one phone call a week.
I've done my duty.
I've nodded. I've done my dishes while I'm on the phone and I'm talking to my mother or whatever it is. I wanted her to have something more sincere than that, like to kind of work through that. Like that was her, I don't know, I was looking for her to have a more sincere human connection with these people, but she sort of had to, you know, I had to put her through the paces of this book to get there.
The other part, too, that I really liked, and again, I think it's a through line in your work, is the attraction and, I guess, interest in strangers.
Hmm.
You know, for all of the disconnect and all of the removing herself, this Andrea, the character, there still is this stop and talk to strangers.
Oh my God,
there
this is so interesting because no one has ever said this to me before.
Am I wrong? I mean, it feels like that, whether it's the actor who's sitting on the steps or it's another character. I mean, there just seems to be this desire by this character to almost act differently when she's interacting with people she doesn't know.
Yeah. Okay. That's really interesting that I don't even know if I have an answer to it. I feel... because you're probably the first person who's ever brought that up, and so now I have to think about it for a second. I mean, that's not...
Well, I mean,
not,
that was the bulk of St. Maisie, right?
Right, was that she was... Yeah, she would help all the homeless.
Right.
Yeah, she helped all the strangers. And yeah, in this book, she is interested in other people. I think I would say that it's like a... It's an urban thing where you're surrounded by strangers, and so you can have like that chance of like an of an intimate connection and then sort of move along. My first book was called Instant Love, actually, too.
It's romantic for a moment.
Romantic for a moment, yeah. But also like... I don't know that we're – I do think that it's like we're – especially when I think about our political climate where I've had conversations with people they, where they say, well, I'm going to be fine, right? And I'm like, yeah, me too. Like I'm a middle-class, middle-aged white lady. Like of course I'm going to be fine. But what about everybody else? So it's maybe a you know, about an idea of connecting with everybody and being responsible for your neighbor. I do think about that a lot, about being responsible for your
neighbor. I just wonder – I mean, there must – I mean, obviously it comes from your brain and this concept that you do are looking for connection, and there is some fascination with the passing stranger in the night. Even in the case of Andrea, I picked up that, you know, a lot of her short-term romances were started with the way she met somebody, the guy at the wedding, you know, or things like that, that were like, it's it starts in this interesting way, and then it kind of peters out.
I guess so. I mean, she has, you know, there's somebody who she – you know, has the longest relationship with is somebody that she went to art school with, of course, and has known him for 15 years or something like that. You know, she can get things, something out of it, but also, like, it's easy to just shut it down, too. It's both of those things.
All right, I'm done psychoanalyzing the characters.
I'm so interested.
It's my guest in the book, All Grown Up. You know, you have been prolific in the way that you have written, it was 3 books in 5 years or something like that? And you're constantly coming up. I mean, it's great to be able to see this book come across my desk and be like, oh, great, Jamie's back. Well, what's the plan? I mean, are you the kind of writer that just keeps churning? I mean, it's like every month you got a new idea and you're...
I don't know. I'm going to take time off. I'm going to take a year off, I think, from writing fiction. That's my next plan, which I never thought those words would ever come out of my mouth. But actually, like last year... Like I wrote this book, I really started writing this book in fall of 2015 and I finished it, like all the edits, everything done in June of 2016.
Okay.
So like a 9 month period.
Is that a normal time for a writer?
I don't know. I think it's fast, but I mean, it depends on what kind of book you're writing, I guess, but it's also a short book. That's a little bit of a cheat too, but I feel like I've said a lot and I don't know what else I have to say at this exact moment in terms of my fiction. I tried to write.
I thought you meant this interview. I thought that's how you were ending
the
interview.
No, I feel like I've said a lot. No,
and I gotta go.
No, I mean out in the like creatively in the world. Right. Like I feel like the especially feel like the Middlesteins and St. Maisie and All Grown Up. They do are connected for sure. Like the themes of empathy and compassion and like connecting with people. I agree with that. Connecting with people, helping people, and so I feel like I've put out so much right now. And that and when I started to write again last fall, I was like, I said a lot. Like I might be done for a minute. So I'm going to see what's going to happen next. But I have another book deal, so I probably I'm definitely going to write another book. And I have a long life ahead of me to do these things. So
are you the kind of artist, though, who fears not having that project that's up next? I mean, the concept, you say it with a little bit of you feel free in a way that you're like, oh, God, I don't have a book coming. I'm going to take some time off. But are you the kind of artist, too, who's like, you know what, I kind of want to – I want to make sure something's in front of me.
It's honestly, I'm going to answer your question in a second, but I want to say that it's delightful to be here, of course. But it is, I've been on tour for like 5 freaking years. So I'm tired. I'm tired of talking about myself. I'm tired of like writing essays to promote my book. I'm tired of like taking airplanes. I'm tired of, you know, all the things that go along with it. Like it's an honor that I get to do it, but also it's physically exhausting and I miss my dog. So like that's really what it is. I think it's just that I've really... Once you write a book, there's things that are associated with it that were never associated with early on in my career. Like there's just like, oh, if I write this, then I have to talk about this, which I didn't. That's why I kind of didn't even really want to write this book, because I was like, oh, if I write it like a single girl in the city book, then I have to talk about being single, even though it's like this book totally breaks the single girl in the city, like the traditional genre, and reinvents it, I think, or that's what I was trying to do.
But that's why people want to talk to you about it, because I do think that there is some interest in developing a another kind of character that lives in New York, that's single, that lives life that's not.
Yeah, no, it's great. I want to talk about it. Right, I do. Right, I want to talk about it. I wrote it so that it could exist. But I was like, ooh, if you do this, then you're gonna have to talk. You know, you're gonna have to talk about it. So I know all the things. It's very it's complicated for me. It's not just about making the art anymore. It's the difference between being a writer, lowercase W, and an author, capital A. But to answer your question, really, which is, do you have to have something to do? I do have to have something to do. I will have something to do. It just won't be writing a book.
It won't be signing copies and talking to us. So the short answer is, we'll see you in a year. You'll be.
No, I'm tired. I want to go and drink daiquiris in New Orleans.
All right. The book is called All Grown Up. The author is Jamie Attenberg. It's a national bestseller. She's a New York Times bestselling author. She is in Chicago, but hopefully we'll get home and be able to hang out with her dog soon enough. Yeah. Jamie, great to see you. Thanks for coming on. All right, coming up, Sam Panionovich is going to join us in the 9 o'clock hour. We'll talk about these upstart Bulls. Who are these Chicago Bulls? Who are these? It has all the feel of a team that is rebuilding, a team that has a bunch of 20-year-olds, and they all sync together at the end of the season. You're like, oh, they're so athletic. But that's not the Chicago Bulls. The Chicago Bulls are a couple of veterans that are on their last legs, literally. They are limping through their careers, their NBA careers, all-stars at their prime. But there's something about the chemistry and the synchronicity, if you will, of Rajon Rondo, Dwayne Wade, and Jimmy Butler as they essentially turn some heads in the NBA right now. They were the laughingstock 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago, they're like, they're not even going to make the playoffs. And now they have won the first two games against the number one seed Boston Celtics. And, I mean, watching ESPN, watching reading NBA coverage, that they're counting the Celtics out. I read a whole think piece this morning about how Danny Ainge is to blame.
Oh.
He's the general manager of the Celtics. Yeah. I was like, they're only down two to nothing. Like, the idea that we've already brought out the thought piece about how Danny Ainge has built, he doesn't know what direction he wants to go with the Celtics, and now he has ruined the 2017 team. You're like, they're still playing.
Boy, yeah, they can come back.
No, I have to be honest. I mean, the one thing as a Bulls fan, and I haven't watched, you know, as close as the Hawks this year, but, you know, the Bulls haven't played that great at the United Center. There have been plenty of times that there have been games where you're like, why are you losing at the United Center? They haven't had a great home record. So the Boston Celtics are a good team. They rival the Cleveland Cavaliers. They're supposed to be there in the end. You know, I don't think just because it's coming back to the United Center means that, you know, it's inevitable that the Bulls will be up 3-0 or leave and go back to Boston at 3-1 or possibly sweep. I don't know.
Yeah. I think the Bulls are 2-0 against the Celtics at the United Center this year, so they have that. I mean, I don't, you know, it does, it's playoffs, it doesn't really matter, but
you know, the only thing you can think about is that besides Isaiah Thomas, the point guard, I mean, and he's a young guy too, but it's a young team without a lot of playoff experience. You're not seeing a lot of the sort of Dwayne Wade's on the Celtics. You know, there's no Ray Allen. You know what I mean? Like someone who does essentially can steady a young team and say, I've been here, this is what we do. The Celtics are kind of missing that.
Missing Rondo.
They're missing
who was there.
Yeah, they're missing a Marcus Camby. That's who they need, right? It's almost like, oh, like an aging Tyson Chandler.
Yeah,
would be good right now for that team. They don't have it.
It is fun watching SportsCenter in the morning, and normally, you know, you never see anything about the Bulls. And now it's like in the, you know, the subjects are on the, you know, the left hand side. You look to see like, oh, what do they got coming up? And it's like three of the things are Bulls related.
Brady skips White House, right? And it says, you know, who will the Browns pick in the first round?
Yeah.
Bulls, Dwayne Wade, and Jimmy Butler. You're like, what?
Yeah, there's like three. They have three topics,
and that's what we wanted. When Dwayne Wade came to Chicago, I mean the concept of in the offseason bringing an aging veteran on this team, there's a lot of questions about it, you know, because you're like, what does he have in the tank? You know, this isn't really rebuilding, but you want that star power because of Dwayne Wade and a Jimmy Butler together, they create a storyline that makes the scroll on ESPN at this time of year.
Yeah,
so I mean that's good for the Chicago Bulls, who otherwise have had a pretty mediocre season. I mean, a season that we wouldn't look back on and be like, remember that 2017 Bulls yeah. team? But for right now, they're hunkering down, and they won the first two in Boston. That's huge. So, I mean, good start. And to be honest, in a very convincing fashion, yesterday's game, I read something that they made it seem like the Chicago Bulls were the number one seed. The dominance that they showed and how they were just moving the ball. Rajon Rondo was moving. Jimmy Butler just sort of, you know, being able to be deployed defensively. Remember Jimmy Butler, the defensive guru, if you will. He being deployed as if, you know, on Isaiah Thomas, just like LeBron James did on Derrick Rose back in the day. So there's something there. And the Bulls have figured something out with the Celtics. You know, like I said, man, Fred Hoiberg, genius. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 10 o'clock, Greg Flam's back for the swap meet, 312-981-7200. So, of course, we do this every week, one of my favorite segments on the radio. People call in, tell us about what kind of memorabilia, what kind of collector's items you have, what you want to brag about, your junk, and Greg tells you if it's worth anything. And then I tell you if you should keep it or not. Like, that's my job, is to try and get the cash registers out of your eyeballs and say, no, you got to keep that. You don't sell that, you keep that. 312-981-7200. Also, Sam Panionovich going to join us a little bit to talk about the upstart Chicago Bulls. Well, let's talk about this. Buttermilk cabbage soup. We got pickled bologna, killed lettuce with bacon and ramp greens. Coming up tomorrow night, the Andersonville restaurant, Big Jones, is putting on a good old Appalachian dinner. Big Jones is a restaurant that focuses on Southern heirloom cooking. And tomorrow night, we're going to welcome cookbook author Ronnie Lundy to cook up some recipes from her new book, Vittles, An Appalachian Journey with Recipes. It's also a fundraiser for the Southern Foodways Alliance. So what is Appalachian cuisine and what flavors will we savor from tomorrow night's event? Joining me in studio, Big Jones executive chef and co-owner Paul Fairbuck. Paul, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Howdy, Justin. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Love your restaurant.
Thanks.
Let's talk about this. I mean, because this is, I mean, you, Big Jones is Southern heirloom cooking. What you're doing tomorrow is Appalachian cooking. Are they similar? I mean, are we talking about the same thing, just sort of different words?
Well, Appalachian cooking is sort of a subtext or a part of Southern regional cooking. And we like to cook. We have a regional focus at the restaurant. We do a lot of Louisiana cooking. We do a lot of low country cooking, but we do have some Appalachian dishes on the menu, and we take the same approach to them that we do to the rest of the Southern dishes that we do, which is to say, we think of our cuisine as heirloom cooking, and that means it's very ingredient driven.
Okay,
we like to have pure unadulterated ingredients like you would have had, you know, say 100 years ago or 150 years ago before industrial food and, you know, before Jell-O started popping up in all of the recipes and you know, canned ketchup, you know, started popping up in all the recipes. Like, what do you have if you are bringing raw produce into your kitchen and working with it? And, you know, that's what I really liked about Ronnie's book. And the stories in it are just marvelous, and it paints a picture of an Appalachia, I think, that most people don't realize.
Yeah, because, I mean, you think of Appalachia culture, there's a folk culture around it, mountain-type culture, but I don't necessarily think of food when I think of Appalachian culture, but it's a big part of it.
Yeah, which is interesting because a lot of foods that you would call iconic Southern dishes actually came down from the mountains. Fried chicken. Which I think a lot of people associate with Louisiana now, which is funny. That started in the mountains. That was freed black slaves who'd escaped slavery, and Germans bringing their Dutch ovens, and the Scotch bringing their tradition, and the African Americans had the tradition from West Africa of frying birds in hot oil, and the Spanish and the Scottish immigrants had a tradition of confiting and preserving chicken in pork fat, and the Germans had these Dutch ovens, and, you know, there's fried chicken, and next thing you know, it's all over the South. And the oldest fried chicken recipe we have endemic to the United States is from Mary Randolph's The Virginia Housewife, which was published in Richmond, Virginia, which is sort of on the fall line. So you start to think of the upcountry leading to the Appalachians. And that was in 1824 in Richmond, Virginia. So the, you know, perhaps the most iconic southern dish came from Appalachia.
You know, I also, I mean, when I think of some of the ingredients that you talk about, you know, are they're going to be featuring tomorrow, a lot of, I mean, a lot of root vegetables, and obviously this is a kind of a transition time of the year because the more sort of greens and the produce will be coming at the end, the spring begins. But talk about, you know, the role of the root vegetable and the produce in Appalachian cuisine.
Yeah, well, Ronnie and I, when we first started talking last summer about doing a dinner when her book came out, sort of focused on this time because it is a really cool time when you think about Appalachian cooking and the traditional nature of it, that right now you have the end of winter. You know, Appalachia is different from a lot of the South. It's certainly different from Louisiana or Charleston, where you have a winter, and it's a deep winter. So they developed a curing tradition. And you have salt pork, you have things like bacon, and you have things like country ham.
Oh, interesting, yeah.
And you have root vegetable storage crops, but you also have ferments, things like sauerkraut, which people don't necessarily think
which
of as Appalachian.
Featured, their kraut will be featured tomorrow.
Yeah, and that's and that was a big deal. That was how you survived in the winter up there. And, you know, so we really like this idea of doing this dinner right now at this time where, you know, you're sort of using up the last of those ferments, but after that long winter and after eating all of this delicious salt pork all winter and all of these ferments, you're just so hungry for something green and fresh.
Well, the food tells a story.
Right. And the first things that come up are ramps and morels. And so they'll figure pretty prominently tomorrow.
All right.
Night.
So tell me about the ramp, because I know that's part of the onion family, but I'm not familiar with ramps as much as I would say, like, you know, onions.
Well, ramps are one of the most abundant wild foods in the United States, in the eastern woodlands. So, I mean, I used to run into them all the time when I would just go hiking out in the woods. Usually, and in fact, I first really discovered morels as a forageable thing when I was out looking for, I discovered ramps as a foreageable thing
looking
when I was
morels,
out looking for morels. And on the way to the morels, you find the ramp, you know, you stumble upon a ramp patch. You're like, this smells like an onion. And you go back and ask Dad, what's this? And it's like, oh, that's an onion. But ramps are very important because they're, you know, certainly in the case of a traditional farming culture in Appalachia was a lot of, you know, families on small subsistence farms. That becomes very important because it's essentially free. You go out and you forage it. And you can cook it, and it's nutrition. So they're a very important food in
what's
in
the
that
taste?
Tradition.
What's the? I mean, is it? It's an onion.
Yeah, well, I mean, you could think of like an onion has a spicy or a sharp taste. Or like a ramp stings. It's like even more potent. It's somewhere, you know, in terms of the heat scale, it's somewhere between an onion and say like a red onion and garlic. But it's also sort of in between an onion and garlic on the funk factor. It's kind of funky. it tastes like, you know, they have a little bit of a taste of the humus on the forest floor, like that, which, you know, if you grew up in the country like I do, is a beautiful sweet smell. But I think a lot of city slickers can
they may not like
be taken aback by it at first.
In studio with me tonight, Chef Paul Fehrbach. He is the executive chef, co-owner of Big Jones, the restaurant in Andersonville. Tomorrow night, a big event. They're celebrating Appalachian cuisine with an Appalachian dinner with cookbook author Ronnie Lundy. Her book, Vittles, An Appalachian Journey with Recipes, is out. They're going to be cooking from the book. It's going to be at the restaurant. You can find out more information at BigJonesChicago.com. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll do a little bit more. I'm fascinated on, you know, as a restaurant that is an heirloom restaurant where you need to do pure ingredients. You know, you're at the whim of local produce of the seasons. We kind of talked about the idea of you kind of being in between. So even beyond Appalachian cuisine, how you as a chef deal with, you know, the ingredients coming when they come. There's no way to manufacture that. Chef in studio. We'll take a quick break. Come back. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight, Chef Paul Fehrbach. He is the executive chef and co-owner of Big Jones in Andersonville, Southern Heirloom cooking. Tomorrow night, Ronnie Lundy, the cookbook author, her book, Vittles, An Appalachian Journey with Recipes. Ronnie is going to be up at Big Jones along with Chef Fehrbach, and they're going to be cooking some of the recipes, a big event. Tickets available, BigJonesChicago.com. You know, I think about Appalachian food, and we, you know, right before the break, I kind of teased out the question of, you know, for you working in, explaining what heirloom cooking is, the idea of working with pure ingredients and not using any canned or anything that might be synthetic or jello, as you said, you know, you're at the whim of seasons. I mean, you just kind of mentioned that here comes the spring, you know, we're entering the winter. How do you have to adjust to that as a chef? I mean, the idea that you can only use certain ingredients at certain times in Chicago.
Yeah, that was actually an interesting part of the restaurant's history. In my own history, but one of the things that really sort of blew up Big Jones, certainly on the local scene, but also to some extent on the national scene, at least in the southern dining circles, was this idea of the historic dishes that we do, and sometimes we'll put, you know, dates on dishes. And that sort of came about because when I decided that I was going to cook, you know, how my great grandparents did in their little farm kitchen. And, you know, I don't have a freezer. There's no freezer. You know, my dry goods pantry is limited. I'm going to do all of my own preserving. I'm going to do all of my own meat curing. You know, how do I deal with seasons? And that was a really hard question. And I found myself digging into old cookbooks at looking for different, you know, different approaches. So I gathered up every Southern focused primarily, but you know, also Midwestern cookbooks that were dated before, you know, say every house had a freezer, you know, in the 1950s. And I found a lot of interesting dishes, you know, dating all the way back to the beginning of the country, and, you know, things that had been sort of forgotten. But I also say, well, you know, a dish like the way we do chicken and dumplings is like my great grandma did. And, you know, she made it in 1920, exactly like I do. So we put that date on the menu. I mean, so you're having that taste of history.
Oh, wow.
And I think one of the keys when you talk about heirloom cooking, whether it's heirloom Southern cooking or heirloom Midwestern cooking or what have you, is that connection to your ancestors of the taste. And it requires the right ingredients and it requires the right preparation methods. But taste is a way you can link to your past and link to your ancestors. Well,
I was going to say, being a chef in this discipline, you essentially are part chef, part historian. I mean, you have to think about what came before you and research and have the skills to be able to do that.
Yeah, and it's fun though for me because I love history. I always have. It's, you know, even when I was a kid in school, I was the nerd that was reading the history book before.
You're supposed to, right?
I would read the whole thing by like the second week of class because it's just been a fascinating subject for me. So it's, you know, I didn't set out when we started Big Jones, we wanted to have a good Southern restaurant like you would find in the South, in a, you know, on Magazine Street in New Orleans or on King Street in Charleston, and, you know, not fine dining, but, you know, nice farm to table food. And it sort of has evolved as a reflection of the way I think and the way I approach, you know, life, which is always with a strong eye on history. And we're obviously moving forward, but for me to move forward requires that sort of that eye on the past.
You know, but doing this event tomorrow and really sort of focusing on Appalachian cuisine, you think about the history of that community here in Chicago. I mean, you're in Andersonville. It's not too far from as we were talking about, Uptown, which was a place where a lot of Appalachians settled here in Chicago. Talk about that. Talk about understanding where communities sort of come and go when it pertains to food.
Yeah, Chicago has a long and intimately intertwined history with Southern communities, with New Orleans and jazz, with the Delta and blues, with the Illinois Central Railroad and the Great Migration. But there was also during the Great Depression and also after the war in the 1950s, there was a huge migration of Appalachians, mostly white Southerners, to the northern industrial cities for jobs. And my grandma left the country outside Bristol, Tennessee, and wound up in Detroit, which is where my mom grew up, as part of that migration. Yeah. And Chicago had a huge Appalachian community. It was called the Appalachian Ghetto in Uptown today, and people brought their cooking with them. And there were restaurants, you know, there were Southern restaurants in Chicago then. And, you know, I guess maybe in the 70s and 80s, there became less and less as we sort of...
Yeah, I was going to say, why don't you see more of that inspired cuisine in Chicago?
I think you're starting to see more of them now, but there was this really strange thing that happened, I think, across the country in the 70s and 80s, was this sort of fetishization of, you know, French and or continental fine dining cuisine, which was not seasonal. You know, why bother, you know, learning how to cook differently in the winter when you can just get asparagus from Peru and put a hollandaise sauce on it? And, you know, in California, in the 1980s, things started to sort of move, progress in a different direction with Alice Waters and all of the stuff she was doing. But the rest of the country was still stuck in the dark ages. And, you know, so there was, you know, the 70s and 80s, I think, for most of America were some pretty dark ages.
And you still see that today. I mean, that's somewhat the roots of what we see with our fine dining organizations or restaurants here in Chicago.
You do see it, but more and more. I mean, I think that to the extent that you do see it, it's in the more institutionalized restaurants that are really, really big and serve a lot of covers, and they have very institutionalized operations that are difficult to change. Certainly the small independent restaurants that are opening to a large extent, there's more and more restaurants that are cooking from the market to the table.
Is there ever a time when you're like, why did I choose to do it this way? I mean, if I could just get my hands on some hollandaise sauce, you know, like is there ever a time where you're like, you know, I love the history of it. I love the concept of cooking heirloom and going sort of, you know, the history part of it. But you know what? Maybe I can cut some corners.
Well, it's certainly a lot of work to do it the way we do. And, you know, we think all the time about, well, you know, maybe we should stop processing our own hogs, because that takes 2 days. That's basically 2 days of work to, you know, to fabricate the bacon and the ham and the pork chops and the, you know, and then they have to have a space to cure in refrigeration for, you know, anywhere from a week to a month, depending
right,
on whether it's
right.
bacon, ham or tasso. But then, you know, you taste it and you think, wow, this is, you know, you can't get this product anywhere else in the world. And, you know, that to me is a tremendous value that we can provide to our guests.
All right. For tomorrow night, is there one dish for you as a chef as you get ready for this event? One Appalachian dish that you're like, I cannot wait to dig into. I cannot wait to create, and I cannot wait to serve to the audience.
Can I give you two?
Yes.
That buttermilk cabbage soup is Ronnie Lundy is already kind of legendary in some circles. I mean, for that soup, it's really amazing. It's something you would never think of, and you put it in your mouth, and you're like, oh my god! You know, it's like crawfish etouffee. You know, crawfish and butter, or you know, peanut butter and jelly, or whatever great food combination you like. It's one of those things. And the other one is this banana pudding, which the recipe she uses in her book is from Ian Bowden, my friend who has a restaurant in Staunton, Virginia, which is this little town up in the mountains, doing food that would be, you know, top flight in Chicago in this little mountain town. But he does this that makes this sweet, it's called sweet and savory banana pudding. And we made this miso banana bread for it. It uses red miso, and it's salty and it's savory and it's sweet. And, you know, that's sort of one of the layers in this banana pudding. And, you know, we made the vanilla wafers homemade and all of that. And that's going to be really something.
Well, Ronnie Lundy will be, her cookbook will be used tomorrow night. Vittles, an Appalachian Journey with Recipes will be part of the fundraiser for the Southern Foodways Alliance up at Big Jones in Andersonville. The executive chef and co-owner Paul Fehrbach is my guest tonight. The Vittles, an Appalachian Dinner with Ronnie Lundy starts at 6 o'clock. And tickets are available at BigJonesChicago.com. Chef, thanks so much for coming in, and can't wait to have you back.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
Give it all you got, take your very best shot, and may the best team win. The time is now, the name of the game is action. They're on the floor, and they're ready to score, so let the game begin. And let's see how the ball's gonna bounce today.
This download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. One of the feel-good stories of playoff sports in Chicago has to come from the United Center, and it's not the ice, it's the court. Chicago Bulls have a two-game lead, a 2-0 lead on the number one seed Boston Celtics. A very big surprise, as many just sort of wrote off the Bulls to sort of be swept out since they struggled to make it into the postseason, actually clinching on the final game of the season, the 8th seed. It's pretty interesting that this team has come together and really sort of dominated the Boston Celtics early, but it is early. It's only the first two games. They head back to the United Center on Friday. Joining us now, WGN Radio Sports, B-ball man, guru, what do we call Sammy Panionovich? We call him wrong. Were you wrong about this team?
Hold on. Can we talk about the Polyphonic Free basketball song that we just played? That was incredible.
That was Beats by Zim. He's bringing it tonight.
I didn't think they would make the postseason because, honest to God, when they traded Doug McDermott and Taj Gibson, and this was back on February 23rd, I thought that was an organizational white flag. The only problem is they kept the best player on the team, and that's Jimmy Butler. And he single-handedly willed them into the postseason. He was awesome. The Bulls had to win 9 of their last 13 games just to get in. And they were able to do that. I mean, it took them till the final game of the regular season just to get into the playoff picture. And now that they're there, everything has changed. And this team is sort of like, it's almost like Rob was talking about it in the news, when you have the front office trying to possibly miss the postseason and get a high draft pick, get into the lottery. But the team said, you know what? We're going to show them. We're going to do what we have to do. And Dwayne Wade was really good the other night. Rajon Rondo is playoff Rondo reincarnated. You've got size with Felicio and Robin Lopez, and you've got a timely performance. You got one in game one from Bobby Portis. You got one in game two from Paul Zipser. But the Bulls have the best player on the floor, and matchups are everything in basketball. And right now, I just think if this was any other matchup aside from Boston, the Bulls would be behind the eight ball. But because it's Isaiah Thomas and he's only 5'9", you can put Jimmy Butler on him. Yeah. And you could blanket Horford with Lopez and Felicio. This is a matchup nightmare for Boston. And I thought that coming in.
You know, it's interesting, too, because I heard that, you know, not unlike what LeBron James used to do to Derrick Rose. This concept, when the game got down on the line, the best defensive player for the Bulls is their star, Jimmy Butler. They match him up, and they take the point guard out of the game. And that's a huge, huge impact, especially for the Boston Celtics offense.
Yeah, Wade brought that up last night, too. He said, it's like we tell Jimmy to go get 30 and then go guard the guy on their team that can get 30. It's very much like what LeBron did in 2011 against Derrick Rose. We saw this high-octane, fast-paced, up-and-down Bulls team that loved to push the pace and play with tempo. When they put LeBron on D. Rose and the floor shrinks in the postseason and you have to go half-court, the Bulls didn't have an answer because their best player couldn't get past LeBron. Right now, Boston's best player can't get past Jimmy Butler. And I'll tell you one thing. I love to read quotes, and I love to hear clips in the locker room. If you heard what Rajon Rondo said last night at the podium, he said that Fred Hoiberg has outcoached Brad Stevens. Mm. And nobody saw that coming.
You know, there's been a lot of talk that, you know, we were talking a little bit earlier in the show just about, you know, the thought pieces coming out today about Danny Ainge and he didn't prepare this team and this isn't the Celtics' fault. I mean, they're almost writing this off as a first round loss. You know, Pete and I were just saying it's only two games and things could shift dramatically come Friday, even a Celtics victory at the United Center on Friday. I mean, from your vantage point as a guy who covers basketball and has watched both of these teams and watches series, is there still basketball to be played? Or I mean, do you follow the sort of, if you read some of the Boston papers, it sounds like they're thinking about what to do next year.
Well, I wonder about Isaiah Thomas. And, you know, clearly he's not in the right place, nor should he be. His sister was just killed in a car accident, and, you know, he's the straw that stirs the drink. I don't know where he is mentally. I'm sure it's very tough for him to focus. That being said, you still have to play the games. And, you know, this Boston roster and this Bulls roster, if you were to line them up, let me ask you, JK, if you're on the playground and you get the first two picks, where are you going? Yeah. I'm going Dwayne Wade 1 and Jimmy Butler 2. I mean, you can flip them one way or the other, but in the postseason, I want those two guys. Of all the players on both sides of the court, those are the two guys I want first and second. Would you agree?
Yeah, and I would even put Rajon Rondo in the top five as well, just from his experience.
Right. So in basketball, it's very simple. There's only five guys on the floor at once, and it's not like football where, you know, defensive line play, offensive line play, special teams and all that. In baseball, the hot pitcher, the hot bullpen, the hot bat. In basketball, where are the best players on the court? And you can make the case that in this series, the Bulls have three, maybe four of the best players on the floor. And that's a recipe for disaster for Boston. And I find it so ironic because at the NBA draft last summer, and I was at Bulls headquarters when they almost made that trade, when Danny Ainge wanted to go all in and trade for Jimmy Butler, but he thought they had enough. Clearly, they don't have enough. They don't have that alpha, that number one star. And it's Jimmy Butler who's making life difficult for those in Boston right now.
Well, you know, we're going to talk again, you know, especially if the Bulls move on. But you get to a certain point when the teams do move on that the other teams do have better matchups against the Bulls, especially you think about just the next round. The Wizards won tonight, John Wall. And, you know, the when you talk about alphas, you start to see the teams that will emerge into the second and third round have these superstar players that it's not as easy to put Jimmy Butler on and have the same results.
Right, and of course, you know, the elephant in the room at the end of the postseason, granted, they're on the other side of the bracket, and that was another very lucky case where the Bulls just missed Cleveland. I mean, if, you know, if Chicago's the 7 and Cleveland's the 2, the Bulls are probably down 2-0 right now, if we're being totally honest. But you can only play who's in front of you. That being said, the Bulls have never beaten LeBron James in a 7-game series, ever. He's been their kryptonite, and until you get him down – and put him out with three zeros on the clock in that fourth loss, he's still going to be there, and he's still going to make life hell for the
Let's
Bulls.
Talk. I've always wanted to do this with you as well, Sam Panionovich, WGN Radio Sports. But, I mean, just the NBA playoffs, watching all the other games as well. What's surprising you? I mean, obviously you're seeing the Cleveland Cavaliers have their way with the Indiana Pacers. Maybe on the other side you see the Houston Rockets not necessarily having much of a series so far with Oklahoma City and Russell Westbrook. What's surprising you out of the first round of the NBA playoffs?
I'll tell you which team is coming, and I think you know where I'm going here. We've talked about this team for a couple of years now. They're still one of the younger teams in the league. Go up I-94 and look at that team in Milwaukee. Those guys are flying right now. And you look at Giannis Antetokounmpo, who's like 6'11", and he can jump from the three-point line and pretty much dunk. You've got a lot of athletic wings. Of course, Jabari Parker's still not playing. But they've beaten Toronto. They took Toronto to the house in game one and beat them there. So that team is on the rise. I do think Washington is very good out east. And then when we shift to the west, I mean, Golden State with Curry, Thompson, Green, and Durant. Right. I mean, that's an all-star team on the floor for Golden State. You still got San Antonio there. But I think when you break it all down, I do think it's a crash course. You're going to have Golden State, San Antonio. I think it's going to be Washington and Cleveland. But I really think the story right now is the leap that Milwaukee took from last year to this year with that young team coached by Jason Kidd. They're coming, and they're coming fast, and they're not going anywhere, man. They're going to be so good for the next couple of years. They've got a kid out of Africa named Thon Maker who's 20. I mean, that core is pretty much all under the age of 24, and they're getting better. They're getting wiser. They're getting experience right now. I think the team in Milwaukee is a team to watch in the future. But right now, I mean, you'd be silly to look otherwhere than probably Cleveland and Golden State, which is unfortunate because every year we turn on the playoffs in June. It's the same teams late in the year.
But they do play great. I mean, it's dramatic. It's good basketball. If it had, last year's series was awesome. The, you know, when you think about this Bulls team, the 8 seed, it's not a prototypical 8 seed. It's a team that had chemistry issues all season long, a lot of head-scratching losses, a lot of difficulty finding out what kind of basketball this team wanted to play. But at the end of the day, you know, basketball, the NBA, is all about stars. And you just mentioned the alpha, but the idea of Jimmy Butler, Dwayne Wade, Rajon Rondo, I mean, that's as you mentioned it just on the other side. I mean, talking about Curry, Thompson, Durant, and Green. I mean, obviously they're a higher caliber of team. Or in Cleveland, LeBron James, Kyrie Irving, Kevin Love. I mean, there is this concept that the Chicago Bulls, maybe in the offseason by bringing in a Rondo and a Dwayne Wade, were thinking the same way.
This is honestly like the Gar Forman dream. This is exactly what he pictured when he put this team together. Now, granted, you put it together like a 12-year-old playing NBA Jam, but it's working out right now. I mean, I picture him watching this game like in the dark at Bulls HQ with the drapes closed. You know, like he's just so excited to see this masterpiece come together. But that's really what it comes down to. You have a superstar, number one. Boston, they kind of have one, but he's 5'9". Bulls have a superstar. And then they've got two guys with rings, Dwayne Wade and Rajon Rondo, and you've got some guys that can make jump shots, and you've got some big bruising bodies that can grab rebounds. And they're taking care of the basketball. I mean, those three guys, those three alphas, they've been rock solid with the ball. The Bulls haven't really turned it over. Right. They've crashed the rebounds. They've made their open shots. And they're relying on experience and talent late in games. They've got more of it than Boston. And, look, if you look across that Eastern Conference, you can make a case that the Bulls are the second or third best team right now. Now, if they play Cleveland, again, like I said, in that first round, we're having a different conversation right now. But you only play the teams in front of you. And I think right now this is a nice little trek. I think they win this series, and then you can flip a coin against Washington. But there's no reason they can't make a deep run this year.
Okay,
no,
let me ask you this. I mean, because we've been sold a strategy and an offensive philosophy here in Chicago with Fred Hoiberg that we're going to run the floor, we're going to shoot threes, we're going to be a lot like Golden State. Now, we saw a mix and match, if you will, all season long. Why are you playing that kind of game with the three-point accuracy that you have in Rondo and Wade? And these guys aren't runners. These are slashers. These might be veterans who know how to play in the half court. Has Fred Hoiberg adjusted to the actual roster that he has as opposed to the other way around?
He's inserted Rajon Rondo back into the fold. I mean, Rondo is their best point guard, and that is the point guard that plays with the most amount of pace. If you watch the Bulls right now, the guards get in the backcourt right away. They grab the basketball, and they just push it. And Rondo has been throwing full-court passes. He threw a football-style pass to Butler, like a 90-foot pass. Butler caught it in stride. Rondo is going to push, and he's going to push, and he's going to keep coming. And if the Bulls' bigs, we talk about Felicio and Lopez and Bobby Portis, when they get that rebound and they get it to Rondo, all he's going to do is run. And when he pushes that pace, you have to account for him attacking with speed, but also it allows those wings to cut as well. And that's really been the difference. I mean, Rondo, we talk about a guy that was benched. We never thought he'd see the floor again earlier in the year. And it's just, it's been like a blessing in disguise that Fred has finally been able to find out his rotations. It's been Rondo pushing the pace. It's been some timely minutes from guys like Paul Zipser and Bobby Portis. But, you know, really, it's been the veterans. But I think everything changed when he finally put in Nico Mirotić and Rajon Rondo back into the fold, because those guys were in the doghouse earlier in the year.
Right.
They've been the difference in this series.
Well, I mean, come on. This is going to be a tremendous weekend for Chicago sports. You're going to have the Hawks win tomorrow night. You're going to have Friday night at the United Center for the Bulls. Saturday, the Hawks, you know, winning again at the United Center. Sunday, the Celtics game 4. I mean, this is going to be a rocking weekend here in Chicago. Sam Panionovich, WGN Radio Sports, joins us. We'll have to continue to have this conversation, of course, as the Bulls go far in this year's NBA playoffs. Sam, thanks for joining us.
You got it. Take care.
Coming up, the swap meet, 312-981-7200. Greg Flam's in the building. We will be evaluating your memorabilia, your collectibles, your junk. What do you want to brag about? My favorite hours of the week, really, because we get to talk with you about some of the things that you cherish, you want to brag about, you want to tell us about, and Greg tells you if it's worth anything. 312-981-7200. You can text, you can call. Greg will answer. Already got one. I love this one. You ready? You're going to love this one. It is a picture. How much is this worth? It's a picture, a screenshot of Rob Martier on CNN.
Well, that's priceless.
Yeah, that's what I said, priceless, yeah. Right? That's one that you want to frame.
Yep.
And you want to put that on your wall.
Yeah. I mean, you blow it up huge.
And they've got Rob sort of in mid-sentence, too, so it's a screenshot of him talking.
Where are you seeing this?
So someone texted in already as we get ready for swap meet. They said, how much is a signed copy of this worth? And it was a screenshot of you on CNN tonight.
Wow. Man. You know, I'm glad that I have a fan, but.
Yeah, we're going to look that up, see what the what eBay says coming up. That's good, though, right? They're screenshotting the TV that you're
on.
It's
all right.
I love
it's good.
You should see that as like a compliment. Like, they're into you. You got a thing going on.
It's the hair, man.
It is.
It's the flow.
You look good. Mm-hmm. Although they do have you in sort of mid-conversation, so your mouth's open saying a word. But
you know what?
Screenshot, it just kind of looks like your mouth is open.
Love those shots where your eyes are closed and the mouth is open. You couldn't look worse.
Yeah. But that's the charm. Imagine that framed up on the wood panel.
A lot of charm.
Of the living room. People come in like, oh, that's my Rob Martier.
Hey, there it is.
There it is.
Well, I'll tell you what. If you print it out, send it in, I'll send it back signed for you.
There you go. See, we're making dreams come true. All right, the swap meet coming up with Greg Flamm here on the download. Looking forward to it. 312-981-7200.
It's time for swap meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flamm.
Yep.
That's right. It's a download, and it's time for Swap Meet. 312-981-7200. This is our weekly segment where we get together and we evaluate your junk.
Yep.
It's a great segment.
It is. It's awesome. It's always fun.
It's always fun.
Always something unpredictable.
And we've already got some people lined up. 312-981-7200. Greg, good to see you. We had last week was off. You were going out to the Allstate Arena. How did that go?
It was awesome. I can't say enough good things about it. 600 to 700 vendors. If you're a buyer, it's heaven. If you're a seller.
600 to 700 vendors?
Yeah. And it's just the whole parking lot outdoors. And this weekend, I think they only go till 10 a.m., but then next weekend they'll go till 3 p.m.
I always see that from the highway if we're going to see
it's,
that.
It's crazy. I mean, it's just anything you can think of wanting to buy, it's there.
Wow. You know, All right. Well, you always like to bring some goodies in to start. So why don't you explain what you brought in today for us in the swap meet.
Okay, well, the geek in me, I found the Star Trek, 1966 Star Trek USS Enterprise model.
Ooh, this is like a glue model?
Yeah, it's a glue model. They already kind of put it together and it's kind of falling apart, but the cool thing is they never used the decal sheet on it, and the instructions are included in it, and I guess it lights up. But yeah, they promoted, you know, when the show was in its prime.
Yeah, there it is,
the NBC network
TV,
And it's this should go for about 70 in this condition, but they can go at like 150. If it was never built, it would be like 150, 200.
Wow, that's nice.
So that was good.
So rudimentary in its technology, that U.S. Enterprise.
Right, But I was shocked to kind of see it at an estate sale when I went to, and how low the price was. The other couple things, I have a Marshall Brodeen magic show, and what I'm researching on these is I'm amazed how many of these he came out with.
Okay, you explain know,
think,
this.
Yeah, it's like, you know, Wizzo from WGN.
Yeah, of course.
You know, I'm thinking,
so it's
okay,
essentially the beginner's magic set.
You know, it's pretty simple, and it includes all the little things you need to do, the different tricks. But looking them up, I had one that was an actual Wizzo one, and that sold for about $25. This one is much larger, and it's about 40 to 50 maybe. But I'm just like I said, there has to be 5 or 6 different magic kits that he put out. I'm like, wow, you know, I thought he'd only have maybe 1 or 2, but kind of surprised how many he had.
Yeah, then, he's going for his. Hey, when you're on top as a magician, you got to be on. You got to
He
it.
Was all over it. Yeah, I mean, props to him.
You can't just have one kit. You got to do five, six. You got to diversify.
Yeah, I guess
He went to business school. Wizzo knows what's up.
Yeah, he sure does. And then I always like 60s, 70s magazines, because sometimes the ads alone, just a one page ad in it, will be worth $15.
Really?
Yeah. So you get 3 or 4 or 5 ads per magazine. You know, you get $45, $60 just for that, and you usually get them for about $1. It's mostly the car ads or audiophile ads inside. I marked a couple here. But,
yeah, what do you got?
This is 1968.
Look magazine?
Yeah, Look magazine. And to give the listeners a hint, it's usually Look and Esquire magazines are the ones that have the best ads. A lot of people think Life and things like that. But yeah, you got your old
Dodge Coronet.
Yeah, you know, and you know, people will pay $12, $15 for that ad.
That's a good looking ad. That's like right out of Mad Men.
Yeah,
look at that.
Yeah, here's another one for Chrysler.
I'm waiting to see Don Draper and Bruce and what was his name? The other guy.
You got me on that.
What was the guy's name? Bruce.
Pete, help
Pete.
Us.
Pete. No, it's Pete Campbell. Okay. Pete Campbell.
All right.
Don Draper.
Yeah, so I'm you know, I like the 60s and 70s era magazines for ads.
There you go. All right, 312-981-7200. Why don't we start? I said, you know, this weekend down at McCormick Place is C2E2, the Comic-Con, coming through town. A lot of artists will be there displaying their work, but also memorabilia comes out in that regard as well. 630 says, my dad gave me a copy of The Amazing Spider-Man number 3 from 1963, the first appearance of Dr. Octopus. It's in good condition, but I've never gotten it personally graded.
Okay. Yeah, as you know, with comic books, just a little bend or here or there can just really swing it.
Really?
Know? And they're looking like they're $150 to $800, you know, if they're in really
good
condition.
That is quite a swing.
So, you know, you might want to take it and have a comic book guy look at it. And then if they say it's worth getting graded, then pay the money to get it graded and see if you got something.
What does it cost to grade a comic book?
I believe it's about $15 per item. You can send in multiple items.
And so you get a grade, and then they like cellophane it?
They
like,
seal it, and if you break the seal on it, then you got, yeah, you like, know, you,
wait till
you,
you
null
hear,
and void that.
We'll take a break and we come back. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you heard earlier in the show, Pete Zimmerman.
I did.
Talking, made a cardinal
yep.
error.
Yep.
The cardinal, St. Louis Cardinals error. And his Kiss doll. So we'll talk about that coming up. With Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. Here's what we're going to do. We'll take a quick break, real quick, 2 minutes. We'll come back, and we will continue with the callers and the texters that are calling in now. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. It's Swap Meet here on the download. Greg Flamm, at DuPage Picker on Facebook and Twitter. He's with us. He's with us every Wednesday. As we evaluate your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk.
Yep.
Call in, tell us what you have, what you want to brag about. Let's bring in Joe. Let's start it off. Joe, what do you want to brag about, Joe?
Oh, I'm on already?
Yeah, hi, Joe. How are you?
Oh, I didn't even hear the click. I've got a...
work on that click.
Yeah, right. A solid brass, I think, circa 1900 or ish, okay. Automobile horn.
Wow.
I bought it about 25 years ago in, I think, Kansas City.
Okay.
And it originally had the rubber, you know, bulbous end, if you will, that
right.
you squeezed and made the sound, which is long since oxidized and just
sure.
Disintegrated.
Yeah.
There's two things on the thing. One is a deluxe in an oval area, and it's spelled D-E-L-U-X-E.
Okay.
The other thing I have is on the solid brass piece that was used to affix it to the automobile or whatever it was on.
Right, the bracket, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's something, I can't quite make it out, but it looks like M-A-F-I-N-I-T-A-E, if that helps you at all.
Hmm.
So you bought this, you bought a car horn 25 years ago, an old...
I bought this, you know, I used to travel the United States and the globe for, you know, whatever. But I also bought a set of Longhorn steer horns that measure 15 feet across.
Wow, well, that's
at the same auto dealership, you know, okay. An old jalopy place.
So, are you in the market for that? Or are you just like, let's go see if there's a horn to buy? Like,
yeah, you know, when I'm in a given area and it looks like it's an antique place that might have something that's unique, if you will,
yeah.
I take the time to check
it
out.
I like
yeah.
it. All right, what do you got, Greg?
Okay, well, their range is pretty far apart, from $20 to $400. I tried to find like $1,900, $1,910.
Mm-hmm.
You do have the bracket, and obviously there's some marks on it, so I would say you're more in the $100 to $300 bracket. I just couldn't find much. There are some with the deluxe that are starting from $20, so, but because you have the bracket, you're probably a little bit higher than that.
You mean that little bracket makes that much
difference? Oh, it does, yeah. The bracket, and then, like you said, the rubber plunger type.
Yeah. I've got a piece around where it was connected, but the bulb itself is
But the rest of it's gone,
dissolved.
Yeah, that will hurt a little bit, but the bracket does make a big difference. So.
Yeah. Gotcha. Hanging in my memorabilia hall, if you will,
okay.
along with my block and tackles that I save.
All right.
I get it.
I love it, man. That sounds like
cool.
Sounds like your hallway is a jam, Joe.
It's fine.
All right, there
cool.
you go.
Thanks,
Joe. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks, guys.
312-981-7200. I think this is probably a good time to bring in Pete Zimmerman, who earlier in the show explained to us, you know, he's moving. So when we're moving, of course, you know, this is when you go through your basement or other places and you're like, oh, look at this, what
I
have.
That's
a huge part of it. And earlier in the show, Pete said he was excited because he had unearthed some things that he wanted to try out on you.
I was listening, yeah.
So, Pete, why don't you explain again the maneuver?
So, I'm moving, so I'm going through some old stuff that I have collected, and one of the things that I have is I have an old doll of Gene Simmons of Kiss.
Classic.
I have a picture of it. I don't know. It's about a foot tall, I guess I say. And he has a guitar and a little prop-up thing. And I don't know if you know, Greg. Gene Simmons is very against selling anything.
Oh, right.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Everything. No.
Toilet paper, coffin, you name it.
That guy sells it.
I thought that was like his, you watched his Behind the Music. You're like, Gene didn't like to sell.
Right.
He was always at odds with management.
That's the SNL skit for it.
Right.
So I had this and I was like, oh, yeah, I want to take a picture of this. So I took it out of the box. Yeah. And I know from listening to this, I know that I probably shouldn't have done that.
Right.
But can he solder it back together so it doesn't seem like the Zyron machine?
Yeah, but at least he has the box. That's the big thing. But the bigger thing is, what year is it? Is it the 1978 one? Oh, no, that looks like a McFarlane, which is more like 2000.
Yeah. We need a little bell or something. We need that horn from Joe.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, you're probably right.
So you didn't hurt it too bad, you know. But, yeah, the fact you do have the box, but did you cut, like, the plastic to get to it, or how did you take it out of there?
Oh, yeah, I opened it up like a gorilla.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there you go. Now we got problems.
Just rip the edges.
But still, you're probably in a good $40 to $50 range, even like that.
Fourth graded it?
Exactly. Right. Wow, 40 or 50 bucks.
Yeah, still not bad. Yeah.
Let's take that to C2E2 this weekend.
There you go.
Let's see what we can get for that.
All right.
Come across anything else?
How about a VHS copy of the William Jefferson Clinton grand jury testimony?
Classic.
Okay.
Yep. Good call.
Look that one up.
Good call. Oh. Now, was it on a VHS that was not marked? Was it one of
those? No, it was marked and still wrapped up.
Okay.
Didn't even open it. I was like, I can't watch this. I got to save it.
Right.
I was hoping it'd be like, we didn't have a very organized system in our house growing up. So my mom would tape stuff and it would be a little VHS for the younger people listening. You have no idea. The DVR system was VHSs. Mm-hmm. And then you would put the label on it. It'd be like Jackie Onassis special. And then that would be taped over by an episode of Northern Exposure, right. You know, and then taped over by the grand jury testimony of the Clinton. So you're like, I don't know what I'm watching, and stuff's just jumping from place to place.
Yeah, I don't know if I bought this. I don't know what, but I August 17th, 1998 is.
Okay.
Yeah, because I have like the last game that was ever at the Chicago Stadium on VHS. Okay. I have Cal Ripken's game on VHS still with me, dumb handwriting on there.
So great. Well, my dad was big into taping all of the Bulls playoff runs. So I have a bunch of VHS games that are just, you turn it on and it's Ahmad Rashad and Bob Costas and you're like, this was in our lifetime? Like, the graphics and the tech, everything is so just really dumbed down.
Bill Walton commentary.
Yeah, right.
And I have, like, unfortunately, I have, like, the 94-95 season. For some reason, I don't have either of those.
The Myers era? Right.
Yeah, I don't have any of the run. You know, any of that.
Well, the Bill Clinton tape is about $1.50 to $10, so if it's sealed, it might be a little bit more.
630 says he has the Kiss coffin.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's a big timer.
Yeah, I don't know what he originally sold that. That just came out not too many years ago, but $2,000, I think they're asking for that.
They're asking $2,000 for the Kiss coffin?
And that,
coffin?
You could still get that like through the Kiss
catalog. Is it a real
catalog.
Coffin?
It's a coffin you can be buried in, yeah.
What?
I'm
I thought this
joking.
Would be like a little action figure size.
No,
it's a real thing? A
friend of mine has the Kiss catalog.
Come
I was
on,
just
man.
Laughing at all the different crazy. Stuff that's in there.
Your memorabilia chasers are crazy that someone Kiss actually made a coffin and now it's worth $2,000 because everyone
I don't think it went up or down. I think it's still available and that's, you know, it's a few years old. It's $2,000. You know, you could probably still get one new for $2,000.
Well, I'm thinking about going to the C2E2 this weekend with my son. There's a little bit debate in the house of dressing up. For Halloween we went as the family from Bob's Burgers. Okay. So my wife wants me to resurrect me playing Tina. She's the adult. She's like the teenager. Oh, hey Greg. And I don't know if I want to walk around dressed like Tina in a skirt.
Yeah.
At the C2E2 for 2 hours. You know what I mean? It's one thing for Halloween, but it's another like to have to go through there and do the whole thing.
Right.
Don't you think it's too much?
Yeah, a little.
Yeah, thanks, Greg.
A little bit.
Greg Flam in studio, 312. 981-7200 is the phone number. People lined up. I promise right after the news we will get to everybody on the line, as well as the texts that are coming in. 312-981-7200. It's Swap Meet. Stay with us.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman
and Greg Flam.
Yep.
312-981-7200. We did Swap Meet here Wednesday night. We got a full line. The lines are jammed. Got a lot of text to get through, so let's get to it. Let's start with Betty. Betty, what do you want to brag about, Betty?
I have a newspaper, Chicago Daily Tribune, dated November the 11th, 1918. Ooh. And the headline says, Great War Ends.
Right.
Wow.
Does that have any value?
Where'd you get it?
I have no idea where it came from. I have a lot of family items I'm going through, and I ran across it.
Nice.
Somebody saved it.
Right? Yep. Good call. It made it through a bunch of moves.
Yeah, there was only one that was sold recently, and sadly only for $20.
Oh, okay.
But there aren't any others, so I'm suggesting if you do sell it, make sure you do an auction, because there isn't many others.
Put it on eBay for $30,000 and see what happens.
Or best offer. Right.
Thanks, Betty.
Sold for $0.02 in 1918.
Oh, well,
yeah,
there you go.
Yeah, there you go. That's a profit.
There you go. If you didn't pay anything.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right. Let's keep going. Let's go to Hank. Hank, what do you want to brag about, Hank?
Hey, guys. You were talking about VHS tapes. I've got Disney VHS. Everyone keeps talking about this black diamond thing. Right. And What's that mean?
There's like a black diamond logo on the spine of these Disney, and I like to tell Chicagoland and however many states I can, it's the biggest urban myth legend ever. They're not worth thousands of dollars.
What do you mean? So like there's a myth around it.
There's like a myth that if
this
black diamond is on the logo on the spine, that they're worth like $2,000 or so forth. And you will see, if you look them up on eBay, the strange thing is you will see sold tapes of this Black Diamond series that somehow someone paid $2,000 for, but I've asked many people and it is a big hoax. They're worth like $10, $15.
Wow.
Yeah. If they're sealed, maybe a little bit more, but if they're sealed, I would just hold on them a little bit longer. They're all going to go up.
You know what? Think about it. I mean, the kids in Goonies, they said that the One-Eyed Willie myth was a myth, and they found that gold. So I'm just saying there might be something in there, Hank. I wouldn't give up just yet.
I got a second one, though. Can I ask about
sure.
it?
Sure, yeah, of course. Go ahead.
Song of the South. It wasn't released. It's a copy, and it's subtitled with Japanese.
And what was the title again? You were breaking up.
Song of the South.
Okay.
Not released in the United States because of, obviously, all the racial tensions in it.
Okay, and that's VHS, or what is that?
That's VHS.
Okay.
So it's Song of the South with Japanese subtitles. So
in
Japan, they're like, yeah, that's all right.
Well, Disney obviously released it at some point, but then with all the racial, and it's never been, obviously, re-released, I guess I should say.
Yeah.
Yeah, again, looking like $10, $15 in that range. You probably want to do some more research on that. But tying into what Justin was talking about, though, there's a little bit more money is the Little Mermaid. People say that there is a phallic symbol on the cover of this one, and they changed it, and that is supposed to be like, okay, now that's worth $1,000. It's not. It's
really?
Like $10 or $15, you know. I walk by him, you know, it's one of those things that just is aggravating.
I'm glad you're setting the record
straight. I hope we inform some people.
All right, thanks, Hank.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, let's keep going. I like this. Let's go to John. John, what do you want to brag about, John?
Hey, good morning, guys.
Hi.
Good morning, yeah.
Well, I'm at work. It's my morning.
Okay, good.
Us too.
I got a stamped ball from about 1969 from the Cubs.
Okay, is it signed? Well, who was it signed by?
It's stamped. Every team member,
The stamp was okay.
Very good condition.
All right, let me see. Because they were coming up
from $15 and up, I will see what the stamp.
You know, I wonder if they end up being worth less because the Cubs won the World Series. You know what I mean? Because the 69 Cubs were the Cubs.
Yeah.
You know, right. Everyone knew that. So even the fact that they tumbled at the end was part of the lore of it. But now I wonder if it's sort of like, nah, yeah, but in, you know, they won it here in 2016.
Geez. Can't find a stamped one.
Yeah, that might be a good thing.
Yeah, hopefully it's a good thing. But
they came out on, you know, one of the game days, they just gave everybody one. And
oh, okay.
Yeah.
My cousin talked to me when he came home from the game, and I kept it ever since.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Get that thing in a glass box and put it right by the door. Right?
It is.
There you go.
Great.
Thanks, John.
Sorry, I can help you on that.
All right. I got a good one here for you on text. The Jetsons, 708. I have a Jetsons lunchbox with thermos that's in pretty good shape. Any ideas? And then I asked what year. He said, doesn't know, but maybe late 50s, early 60s.
There you go. That's what I was hoping. The 1963 Jetsons box with the thermos have sold for about $925.
What? Do they have to be in like mint condition? Or
I guess just good condition is what it looked like.
Could you have like a little Debbie's in there maybe?
Well, that could be taken up. But yeah, if you have like the 1990s Jetsons, those are only like $28. Yeah, but yeah, if he's got a 1963, that's great.
And, yeah.
Even right. The thermoses by themselves, I've seen go for about $200.
What?
Yeah, so hopefully he's got that one.
Who is giving $200 for a plastic thermos from a kid's lunchbox?
Well, this would be probably a steel one.
Sorry.
With the real glass. Yeah, sorry.
Steel,
yeah,
not
the 1990s
bad,
would be the
bad.
Plastic, yeah.
Now, I understand now.
No.
Right? Come on.
You have been schooled.
All right, let's keep going. Let's do Bob. Bob, what do you want to brag about, Bob?
Hey, yeah, hey, I got this artwork signed by Ruby Tuesday.
Okay.
And it's autographed by him, and he laminated it, and I have pictures of him drawing it, of the red tongue, like the Rolling Stones album
right.
cover, because okay. Ruby Tuesday is the artist of that cover.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And how big would that be?
It's approximately, I want to say, 10 inches wide by about 18 inches long.
Okay.
So is it just all lips?
It's
or all
just
tongue?
The big tongue.
Tongue.
Yeah.
The big red tongue, yeah.
Yeah, right.
It looks just like the album.
I thought the right. Rolling Stones were lips. They're tongues?
Yeah. It's lips with the tongue, yeah.
Oh, lips
no,
and
it has
tongue.
The big tongue.
Yep.
And lips and the tongue.
That's pretty
got
rare,
it.
So yeah, I'm not finding, tongue. Even by the artist Ruby Tuesday, I'm not finding anything right now.
Any relation to the restaurant? The Ruby Tuesday restaurant?
Not that I know of. I know that he was the one that did the album cover for the Rolling Stones.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. If you want to shoot a photo, either Facebook or Twitter, you know, I'll be happy to research
it. He'll help you out. At DuPage Picker on Facebook or Twitter.
Yep.
All right, cool.
Thanks,
right,
Bob.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks a lot, guys. Love your show, too, by the way.
Oh, thank you,
buddy. All right, let's keep going. Let's see. I've got a couple of things here. Let's go to Robin. Robin, what do you want to brag about?
I would like to brag about a newspaper that I found while I was going through some recipes. It is an original newspaper from when the Cubs won the first World Series. Yeah,
wow. Like just tucked away in a Julia Child recipe
tucked
book?
Tucked away, yes.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it. I'm reading it. The article is fabulous. You know, the sports pages are fabulous about it. So that's pretty cool.
That's absolutely cool.
Right. Are you?
Yeah.
Are the pages so brittle you don't want to touch them, or how do
exactly.
you have it?
Exactly. No, it's in good shape.
Okay.
Because I put, you know, they were tucked away forever, and I just went through something old and went, oh, my God.
Yeah, that's
I can't
pretty
believe
good.
This.
I'd love
I can't
to see
believe
that.
This. Oh, yeah.
I don't
yeah.
even know what to put a value on that, but it's pretty rare.
Wow.
Yeah, it is rare.
I also
have one other is an original Chatty Cathy doll.
Oh, yeah.
Chatty Cathy.
Yeah, we've had
Chatty
those before.
Cathy.
It
what has
is
a
Chatty
pull
Cathy?
Cord.
Yeah.
Chatty Cathy was a girl doll. It wore glasses and had a ring with a string attached, and it had the voice box, and you pulled the ring out, and then it would say some phrases.
Obviously,
that
she was
Chatty,
chatty
Cathy.
Right?
Right.
Chatty
do you have
Cathy,
do you have the box or anything else with it? Any other?
Yeah, I have the Chatty Cathy game.
Oh, okay.
To go with it, yeah.
It looks like the doll alone can go upwards of $400.
Oh, my word.
Yeah. There you go. Tonight's
word.
Yeah. So if you have the box, obviously, you know, yeah. So a box or any other accessories would definitely get you in that range or higher.
Okay.
But otherwise, you can, you know, I've seen also anywhere from 25 and up if it's just like the doll and missing a bunch of accessories and stuff.
There you go.
Oh, no. She's fully, you know, dressed with the glasses and everything. So
yeah. Well, definitely do an auction if you do sell it so you maximize what you can get for it.
All right.
All right.
Thank
thanks, Robin.
Thank you very much.
Thank
you.
Thank
you.
All right. I should have asked Robin. I liked Robin's. She was really good there. Maybe she'd be interested in the Hawthorne Racecourse package.
Right. Yep.
All right, let's take a quick break, and we'll catch up. I got a lot to do here. 708, the Jetsons thermos and lunchbox. She said, I'm a she, by the way.
Oh.
Because we just kind of, on text, we always kind of like defer to like, oh, he might have a great lunchbox, but.
Yep, we'll verify that year of that lunchbox for sure.
There you go. All right, 312-981-7200. We'll come back, and we will finish up in the swap meet. Stay with us. All right, it's Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. Got a lot of people on the line. We got some texts as well. 630 says, I have an original astronaut Barbie, circa 1985. Worth anything?
I couldn't find the actual Barbie, but the outfits were like 25 to 30 each, just for like the individual outfits with it. But yeah, I couldn't get the actual Barbie itself, though.
All right, 1965. What do you think these Peanuts 3D... paintings are worth?
Yeah, they're cool. They're like 3D plastic paintings. I don't know, like 8x10. They're about $50 to $60 each. So
wow.
I had a Snoopy one not too long ago. They're really cool.
All right, there we go. And then Joy, who texts in, says always a great show. She has some. I guess these are tennis rackets.
Okay, yeah,
a Bancroft Billie Jean King set of looks like sort of like a 1970s either tennis rackets or badminton or something like that.
Yeah, don't have that. Just a second here. I
looks
mean,
like
if
a,
it's a
nice
real
set.
Signature, yeah. It could be $300 to $400.
I don't know.
It's
it
real.
Doesn't. I didn't look. It does. It looks like it just came with, like, you know, how I would have like
right, like
Ryan
the,
Sandberg on my
the glove
but
right.
Then, yeah.
Yeah. If it's like that, then you're probably $25-$30 maybe.
Like a Paul Molitor.
Right.
Was it Jim Gantner? Was it Jimmy Gantner? Jim? Yeah. I feel like I had a Gantner.
I had a Pinella glove.
Oh, nice. There you go.
Growing up in my little league team. Yeah.
That's what we need to do. We need to get
Wish
into
I had
business.
That.
You should collect up all the gloves you can, and then we would just have fun reading the 80s baseball players that had signed on
the signatures. Yeah. Right. Yep.
Oh, there's a Willie Wilson.
All right. That will be my quest this summer.
All right. Good. All right. We got some work to do.
Okay.
All right. You ready for rapid fire?
Sure.
I've got full lines. We're going to get them in the next 5 minutes. Here we go.
All right.
Are we ready? Are you ready? Stanley. Why don't you start us off? What do you want to brag about, Stanley?
I've got a Thermax electric toaster.
Ooh.
I think it's from the early 1900s.
Right.
Mm.
Those
the
go for...
down. You can see the electric. You can see it like glow. And there's...
Sure.
It's totally...
You can feel the kitchen fire.
There's usually two
in.
Pieces to them as well. Do you have both pieces? Or
I'm sorry?
I'm noticing there's two pieces that come with this toaster.
Pieces.
Do you just have one? Is it just a toaster, or is there's like a second piece? I don't know what it is, but I'm seeing that a lot on the higher end ones. But you're still looking at $20 to $90 for it. Mm. 90 has kind of been the highest.
Both sides come down, and you just plug it in, but it's got no on and off switch.
Yeah. Right.
I'd plug it in and start toasting everything in the house, see what happens.
Right.
When I got it, I did it to decorate the kitchen, and I picked it up for like $5 and. Plugged it in and it works.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, I would unplug it. That would be my thing.
Yeah.
But you're $90 tops on that.
Thanks, Stanley.
Oh, cool.
Thank you.
All right, let's keep going. Let's go to Kent. Kent, what do you want to brag about?
Yeah, I was wondering. I have it's an insert from, I believe it's the Chicago Tribune. It's like a 6 to 8 page insert of the day after John Lennon died.
Ooh, okay.
It's got like 20 different articles about him.
Okay.
Wow. Good journalism, local journalism.
Yeah, I'm thinking looks like they're going for about $15 to $25.
Yeah. There you go.
Okay, and then can I ask you one more
thing?
Sure,
yeah. Hit us.
All right. I also have some They look like postcards from Disney back in the day, back in like 1961 to 64.
Sure.
And they're three-dimensional.
Three-dimensional.
Ooh.
Hmm.
I don't even know what that means. What is three-dimensional postcard?
They almost look like a hologram when you
turn it. Oh, yeah.
Is it lenticular, where when you move it, it looks like it's moving?
It doesn't look like it's moving. It just gives a really deep 3D effect.
Okay. Yeah, I love those.
Yeah, I have to look that up.
I like those.
And they're mostly of the Jungle Book.
Oh, okay.
All right, we'll look that up.
Yeah.
All right, thank you, Kent.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, let's keep going while you look that up. Sure. Let's do another Disney. Let's go to Dave. Dave, what do you got, Dave? What do you want to brag about?
Hey, I got a picture, a hand drawing by Philo Barnhart, who drew a bunch of the Beauty and the Beast stuff for the movie.
Mm.
And he has a picture of Lumiere with a big old cigar in his mouth, lighting it with one of his candle hands.
Oh, wow, nice. And how big
is that?
It's
really cool.
How big is that?
It's like 8x10. Okay. It's about 8x10, and then my friend who gave it to me framed it, and so it's got a real nice frame in it.
I like that.
But,
nice. It's cool.
Yeah.
I'm trying to help you here.
Where'd you get it? I mean, where'd your friend get it?
He was at a dinner, and the guy was doodling, and so he asked him if he could draw it.
Wow.
It was pretty cool. I don't think I would ever sell it, but
that is
I
awesome.
Just wanted to brag about it.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. Love it, Dave.
It's a good
Thank
brag.
You.
I just can't find a real painting of it.
That's an original.
There you
Thank
go.
Thank you, Dave. All right, let's go to Gary. Gary, what do you want to brag about, Gary?
I have several dozen original black and white photographs from a newspaper that went out of business, major paper in the 70s. And they are of American Indians in South and North Dakota around the time of Wounded Knee protests and so forth, including, teepees and communal life, as well as a rare one of a snake dance being performed.
Wow.
Snake in the mouth dance while the tribe is around watching. And quite a few things like that, including markups for publishing in the paper, as well as captions to be printed or copied out of the newspaper and pasted on the back.
Sure. I am finding some things, like you're talking about, printups from newspapers and some black and white photos. They're about $15 to $20 each. So
there you go.
You can decide if you want to sell them each or as a lot.
Just a question. How do you get around any copyrights for a newspaper?
Photo? That's
a good question. If you know what newspaper, you could try to get the rights from it. But
maybe you just publish them and then say copyright is unknown or in question, whatever. Yeah. And if they complain
right.
or someone complains, otherwise
bucks,
you're free.
Yeah.
I don't think you'll have much problem with it.
All right, thanks, Gary.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, and last one, Ron. Ron, what do you want to brag about?
Yeah, I got this robot commando toy from the 60s.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's in the original box. Everything works.
Wow.
Did you open the box like Pete did with the kiss
thing? Open.
Oh, it was? Okay.
Yeah, the box is open, original box. Everything's original.
Yeah, but the box just kind of probably pulled off the top of it, right, where you could reclose it, right?
Oh, yeah, that's reclosable.
Yeah. Robot Commando, huh? Let me see.
I like the name. I like the Robot Commando. Yeah. I feel like it needs a theme song to
go.
Yeah,
all those old tin.
Robot Commando toy.
Well, a good sign is that people are selling the parts for like $10 and $40 for individual parts. So that's a good sign. Now I'm trying to find the actual guy.
All right.
Well, that's good.
That's good they're selling the parts, right?
Yeah, so that's a good sign always with any games or anything. If you see parts being sold, that means the actual, if you have the whole thing, it's a big money then.
All right. All right, thanks, Ron. 312-981-7200. I'd say the number, but we're done tonight. Greg Flamm, as always, you can find him at @DuPagePicker on Facebook and Twitter. To be honest with you, Greg, I hope we don't have you next week because that would mean Game 7.
It would,
of
so
the,
go Hawks, right? Yeah.
We want the Hawks to obviously go on, but if for whatever reason they don't, you'll be back
I
on
will.
Wednesday. Greg, thanks for being here, buddy.
Thanks, Justin.
All right, that's going to do it for the download tonight. Tomorrow night, Blackhawks hockey. We'll be back on Friday with one of the most influential hip-hop performers of all time, Big Boi from Outkast, joining us on the show on Friday. He's going to be doing a DJ set at the Mid coming up this weekend. Patty Vasquez up next. Patty, how are you? Good
I'm
to see you.
Good. Good to see you, too. I was just hearing you talk about hopefully you won't see him next week for Yeah, here's the thing. Don't you think just one game at a time?
That's right.
All they got to do is win tomorrow and then win game six or game five and then game six, game seven.
Jonathan Taves said something that made a lot of sense to me in the way that he said it's harder for the Predators to win a game four than for us to win our first game, meaning that, you know, it's hard to close
keep
out
momentum.
Yeah, you know, so the idea that they're going to at least disrupt the idea, you know, Nashville from just sort of
one game at a time, skate in front of the other, everybody.
Take 4 days, four games at a time.
Well, if you take it that way, you can't. You have to get one. You can't think we have to win four. You think we have to win one, and then we have to win another one. And we've done this before. The Cubs actually did.
I appreciate your optimism.
But I feel like I had this conversation with you during the playoffs for the Cubs.
Yeah, they were down.
We were down, right? And everyone's like, they're not going to be able to make it back. And we kept saying, you got to win one, and then win the next one, and then win the next one. Every game is its own game. That's all.
That's right.
You know?
Now you got me all excited.
You should be excited. It's the Blackhawks. They're capable
Hockey,
of everything.
Baby.
They're not just capable of anything. They're capable of everything.
Oh, man. It's all jacked up. What's on the show tonight?
Wow.
I know, right?
What? Come on, everybody. Everyone's so down in the dumps. My whole Facebook feed is like, it's over. What is wrong with you people?
No,
can you imagine if they acted that way? How are they supposed to?
They're pros.
All right. Pick yourselves off of the ground.
I agree with you. They're going to win tomorrow. They'll win Saturday. They're going to win on Monday. And then Wednesday.
Boom.
That's right.
I don't know about all that. I'm just talking about tomorrow night.
Just tomorrow night. One game at a time.
We have Brandon C. Price, who was one of the co-creators of Vamp, the music, comedy, and drinking show every Friday and Saturday night. We also have, I feel like we have more coming up. There's so much on the show tonight, I can't really remember
all of it.
We have the guys from Guard Llama. They were on Shark Tank the other night.
Yeah, that's right.
We'll talk
about
them soon.
I saw that.
Excellent. Have a great night.
Have a great show.